The Off the Ball Podcast Network. OTB
AM. Brought to you by Pandora. Celebrate love with a special gift.
Right, a very good morning to you. Welcome along this Wednesday morning to OTB AM. It's Gerry Gilroy here with you until 9:30 alongside Owen Sheehan. Owen, how are you?
Very well.
We've got a busy show for you lined up today.
Very busy, actually, yeah. I'm looking forward to it.
Paul Rice is going to come in, talk to us about the Director General's report yesterday and also about the what sport needs from the next government. Obviously, there's an opportunity for all of the political parties to do something good with
sport. Be in government.
And to be in government at the moment. Literally everybody has a chance of being in government. If they just play their cards right over the next 10 days, don't, you know, say anything stupid at any celebrations, you've got a good chance of getting in.
Yeah, even if you celebrate stupidly, well, you have a chance of getting in, to be honest. it's like, forget about the long-term gains, just focus on the short-term, and you can be in government, really, is how people might approach it. But Paul Rouse has gone through all the manifestos over the last few weeks, looked at all the sports policies. I'd imagine in some cases it probably wasn't too much work.
Pretty short.
But he has gone through them all, and he's come up with his ideal sports policy for whatever kind of mishmash government we end up proceeding with, what they should be doing. There will be questions about how the Department of Transport, Tourism and Sport would look in an ideal world, according to Paul Rouse, whether or not that should be the department, whether or not it should be sport alone, or whether or not sport should actually be in with other potential portfolios to actually make a more cohesive department, I guess, is something we'll be discussing with him later on. And then, of course, all this money with the GAA.
Yeah, so Tom Ryan's annual report, the Director General's annual report, is an opportunity. It's a big... It's not a snapshot, but it's a moment in time of what the leader of the GAA's organisation, their professional body, actually thinks about how the organisation is trending. And in some respects, the president is supposed to be the most important person who sets the agenda and sets the policy tone. But actually, it ends up that the person who is the director general is there the whole time and outlasts all the presidents and can put roots down and put plans in place and can begin to see the fruition of those plans. So a hugely important role and a big opportunity to make a statement about what you think is the direction that the organisation should be heading in and is heading in. So we'll see what kind of a job Tom Ryan has done when we get Paul Rouse's take on that. Some of the top line stuff that's coming out is the debt around Porky Cueve, which is between 20 and 30 million, depending on how it's accounted for. It's quite a significant amount of money when you consider that the entire country and the government went into paroxysms of panic about what was happening with the FAI and the stadium debt for the Aviva and their general debt as well. So Cork GAA faces a fairly tricky time.
For sure, and I think Tom Ryan, in all his media dealings yesterday, basically said that we can't allow this to happen again, that we need to be careful about allowing a county board to take full control of a project like this.
The other thing was the pressure on the volunteers keeps coming back. And what can we do to alleviate the pressure on the volunteers? Because if you imagine that you're a volunteer in a county, whatever county, and that county's taking on a big infrastructural project and you happen to be the treasurer or involved in the finance committee.
And you could find yourself in such a position.
Like, a lot of counties have found themselves in that, where you're a school teacher or you're working in a factory or you're doing whatever it is and you are not financially qualified. But you're
a journalist.
Exactly. You're left with signing checks and statements going, it don't add up. What's happening here? Like, it's not because you've siphoned the money away. It's because you don't really know what you're doing. There's a technical accountancy skill that needs to be injected into that level of project. And irrespective of how big the project is, if it's a small stand in a local GAA club, you need somebody who knows what they're doing.
I think as well that the Parky Cueve situation may not be viewed as grave as it is, because it's probably not a detrimental situation for the GAA, given how much money they do have and given how they'll probably get around the situation over the next few years eventually. But it is a huge red flag for any future projects that are coming down the line, that these people just can't be allowed to run away with these projects and run them themselves without actual central analysis. Like somebody like Tom Ryan, Mulryan, for example, his successor as financial director of the GEA? Like, is there a number of those people that needs to be working on these projects? Because this is not the end of GEA projects happening. You've got Navan, of course, happening at the moment. You've got Casement Park, hopefully, happening down the line. You've got a number of other projects that are going to be taking place as well, that proper financial management of these things and a trained eye over the balance sheet on these things is essential at this point, because you don't want another Parky Queef to crop up. But thankfully, the GAA seem to be in rude health financially and they can deal with this.
Well, at central level, they are. They're making loads of money. 74 million windfall is the figure that the Indo has. So the top line figures, we'll get through them with Paul Rice a little bit later on. But if you want to get involved in the conversation this morning, you can use the hashtag OTBAM or you can always follow us at Off the Ball. What else are we talking about this morning?
We're going to be in the newspapers getting into Tiger Woods and his comments about a potential new golf league, which is something that's been floated over the last month or so. Phil Mickelson was talking about it. There's good stuff in the newspapers on rugby. Gordon Darcy writing about some of the things he spotted in Mike Katz's attack. We're going to have Stephen Ferris joining us a little bit later on as well. A number of different things coming out of the weekend that you could talk to an Ulster back row about. But on the back row element, you've got this potential idea of CJ Stander being a six. And then on the Ulster side of things, Rob Herring, one of their best players, one of the best Ulster representatives in the Ireland team over the last few weeks, but is his position actually under threat from Ronan Kelleher? And then, of course, the other Ulster man who's going to be talked about quite a bit into the lead-up to the England game, and especially for the Italy game if he doesn't play, is Will Addison.
My quick two cents on Herring and Kelleher is Kelleher was absolutely, after the World Cup and the start of the season, he was absolutely our number one hooker, but then he got injured. And now you've got a brilliant scenario where there is somebody who has played really well and the incumbent is going to defend against the young player coming up. And I think you've got to keep Rob Herring in that position for now until he actually gets overtaken, until Herring has an opportunity. Maybe that's after the Italy game. So the England game, it's still Herring, then Kelleher. And in the Italy game, you have Kelleher his chance. And then it's like, look, for the championship decider against France.
Grand Slam decider.
For the Grand Slam decider against France. Probably England, 7-point favourites for us. So whatever. But I think Herring has not done enough. I think Herring has done absolutely enough to continue in the team, and he hasn't done enough to drop out of the team.
Especially when you look at how terrible our lineup was against England in the World Cup warm-up game last year, when it just collapsed. Whereas that game was in Twickenham, and you think to yourself, right, Herring's done okay in this department so far. A steady pair of hands. At least just win our own lineup ball against England this time, and let's not get hockeyed. So I think that starts with the hooker, and I would be surprised if Herring lost his place now.
Right. Leeds United remain in the Championship automatic promotion places just following last night's 1-1 draw away to Brentford. Liam Cooper's goal earned a point for Leeds, but they've taken just 10 points from their last 33. Fellow promotion hopefuls Nottingham Forest fell to a 1-0 defeat at home to Charlton, so it's squeaky bum time at the top of the Championship at the moment. Republic of Ireland striker Scott Hogan scored his third goal in as many games for Birmingham, who were 1-0 winners away to Barnsley. So he's crossed the city from Villa and has his Villa hell is over. Does Scott Hogan get into the Ireland squad in the back of three goals in three games? Like, get close to team? He's not close to team.
Probably 100% you'd be talking about him for a squad member, yeah.
Daryl Lenihan opened scoring for Blackburn in their 3-0 win at home to Hull. Wigan and Borough drew 2-2. Swansea and QPR played out a goalless draw. West Brom can open up a 6-point lead at the top tonight with victory away at Reading. Elsewhere, Fulham will go second with a win at Millwall. Bristol take on Derby. Cardiff go to Huddersfield. Luton play Sheffield Wednesday and Stoke entertain Preston. Leeds lie on 56 points and just 6 points separates them and Bristol City, who lie outside the playoff spots, in seventh. So quite the dramatic league. The GAA announced record revenues of 73.4 million in their annual report yesterday. Now, DJ Carey, meanwhile, hoping to lead IT Carlow to first ever Fitzgibbon Cup win this evening. They face holders UCC in DCU at 7:30 tonight. The Chinese Grand Prix, scheduled for April the 19th in Shanghai, is off due to the coronavirus outbreak. It's uncertain if the race has been postponed or cancelled, and today's scheduled meeting at Ferry House has been rearranged for Monday, the 24th of February. For clarity, Tom Ryan has said all such projects will go through HQ from now on. That was the big infrastructural projects when it comes to that. Right, time for the sports pages. Oh, here's the top. OTB AM. Yeah, that's what's coming up. I should have told you that. We've got Irvin Merchnick, who's been covering the George Gibney trial and story over the last decade and a half, is going to join us a little bit later on. I'm going to play some of that just a couple of minutes' time. Starting with the Irish Independent this morning, though. This is the first day, first full 24 hours of the Irish Independent going behind a paywall. So if you want to read these stories, you're going to have to buy the newspaper or pay for it today. GAA laughing all the way to the bank with €74 million windfall. This is Colm Key's story. Record receipts dampened by €31.5 million financial black hole that is Páirc Uí Chaoimh. Tiger national bid in doubt as O'Leary vents his fury over a ridiculous mark. We'll deal with this in more detail when Tom Malone comes into studio a little bit later on, around about 8.35 for us. Tiger Roll is now a major doubt for the entry Grand National, Michael Burney reports, after Eddie O'Leary blasted the ridiculous rating of 170. So obviously, Tiger Roll bidding to become the first horse to do a hat-trick in a row at the Grand National, and has been given 11 stone 10, the same mark as stablemate and Gold Cup contender Delta Work. So we'll have a serious think about whether he'll run or not. I mean that. He's really not certain to line up at the moment. It's 50-50. Clips yesterday of Gordon Elliott talking about how great it would be just to get him to the start and all the hype that would be involved. So Gordon Elliott is like, I mean, come on, we're going, lads. What are you doing? We're bringing that horse. We're bringing the horse to Aintree. Come on. It's like one of the biggest things that's ever going to happen in anybody's life. Mm. And just because the handicapper has made, he's not going to win, like, can we not go anyway?
We need more roguery from handicappers, just to try and turn the screw on people who are willing to say something in the world of racing, because too often it's polite. There's too much respect between the likes of the Mullinses and the Elliots, and I know the owners are often liable to say something interesting, but I guess this is a sport involving animals that can't speak, so you don't really have trash talk all that often. But this is it. This is what we want. This is the theatre being created by the O'Learys here, who I suspect will be okay with running the horse despite being hit with top weight.
I mean, I don't know. Michael O'Leary is just the type of man who would be like, no, you all want it? No.
Take his ball and go home?
Yes.
I don't think so. I think the idea of wandering back out with the ball, placing it down the centre circle and beating the bigger kids in a game of five-a-side is probably what motivates someone like Michael O'Leary. And get your money on Tiger Roll. The Irish Times this morning, Gordon Darcy says Andy Farrell was right when he said competition is a friend of ours. He's spoken about the Ireland versus Wales game. It does a bit of a section on Mike Katz attacking scenario here. He says Larmer running ball back, kept looking for the middle of the pitch. When I saw Jordan and Aki popping up as first receivers on the short side, Mike Katz's coaching was apparent. You've also got McFadden waiting for his chance to shine. For Leinster, Lancaster's men looking to extend winning sequence against Cheetahs at the RDS this weekend.
The Herald back page is the same two back page stories as the Irish Independent this morning. GAA €74 million cash boost and Tiger Roll a big doubt for Aintree.
The Irish Examiner then is a clear picture. Cork GAA left with €20 million debt on Páirc project, and Kieran Shannon is writing about the Premier League. Manchester United need to invest in a potch future.
The Racing Post, let Tiger roar. With news that dual winner is not a certain Grand National starter, as the weights are revealed, David Jennings urges the O'Learys to go for it. Come on, go for it. The whole world's going to be watching to see if he can do it again, because it would be ridiculous if he did. But imagine if he did, even off top weight. All the better. What a great story that is. Mm. The handicapper tried to stop us, but nobody could.
And then if it doesn't go well, if Tiger Roll doesn't win.
The handicapper.
Yeah, it's a more authentic story then. Back page of the Times is China Grand Prix called off due to virus. Athletics cash under threat. Athletics in Britain plunged into turmoil only 5 months before the Tokyo Olympics yesterday, when UK Sport launched an independent review into the sports crisis hit governing body. The review could lead to a cut in funding for British athletes. It's not been a good few months for British athletics whatsoever. And Beth Ann Tribute from England. England will wear black armbands today during 2020 match against South Africa in memory of Beth Ann James, the daughter of Times sports writer Steve James.
What's the bad few months for athletics?
So, as I said, there could be a funding cut for them, because UK Sport, they're launching an independent review into whether or not UK athletics was fit for the future. So they've got concerns about their strategy, about their leadership, about their governance, operation, the culture. This obviously is after a couple of weeks ago when this potential medal table came out, and they were like, oh, we're not going to win any medals and we're going to be way down on the last Olympics, which is way down from the previous Olympics, which of course was held in London. the whole idea that this was Super Saturday was going to create a legacy of success on the track, and I guess in field sports as well, for Great Britain, it has turned out to be false. So there's been questions asked about whether or not UK Athletics are doing what they've needed to do in terms of churning out top-class athletes, or whether or not actually this was just an unattainable peak, 2012.
I mean, yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? Irish Daily Mirror for you this morning. Bands on the Run, GAA. So this is Pat Nolan's story. There'll be no concerts at Croke Park this year due to Euro 2020. Croke Park Stadium Director Peter McKenna claims the number of touring acts has been diminished by the fact the soccer tournament will take place in 12 different cities across the continent this summer, with four games taking place in the Aviva. Last year, obviously, Croke Park played host to
Westlife and Spice Girls last year.
Remember, yeah, well done. You were at the Spice Girls, obviously, which earned, ensuring a bumper 2019, as the ground earned $10.5 million for the GAA. So Croke Park is obviously run a separate GAA-owned company, but a separate company, and then it returned $10.5 million to the GAA coffers, which is quite a lot of money.
Yeah. Could they not, like, this is, maybe it's a bit of a leap, but since when are the GAA the people to inform all music fans around Europe that your favourite massive band won't be coming to your city this year? Like, is there not other play? Like, if there's somebody not playing a massive gig in Ireland, could they not just play in Phoenix Park instead?
I don't understand. What's your question?
Like, he's saying that bands aren't touring Europe because of Euro 2020.
Yeah.
There are other places to play music outside of the biggest stadium in each city. So, like, he's basically saying that nobody's coming to Dublin because of Euro 2020.
I think the point is that because there is massive infrastructural projects involving all of the light and sound people in all of those major cities, the bands have looked at it and decided we're not going to go head to head with that thing.
Yeah, possibly. You know? But then also there's other sections of the summer that will be free in Dublin.
Like,
but maybe
August, July.
Possibly, I don't know. Like, it's he's probably right. I didn't even think of that whole idea that there's also a finite amount of staff who run these
presumably
massive
that's what it
shows.
Is. It's not like the bands have come, the live promoters, Live Nation and whoever, have come and said, we're not touring anybody this year.
Because all our staff are working for UEFA.
Or, well, I don't know, but
But that is probably it. Back page, and this is that story here on the back page of the Irish Daily Star as well. Euro for Croker. Croke Park Stadium delivered a record €10.5 million to GAA coffers in 2019, and also warning that there will be no concerts at Croke Park this year. €140 million. Jadon Hunt is the main story, though. United leading the way in Sancho pursuit. Edouard's quiet life. Alzon Edouard insists he's never suffered from racism in Scotland and would be the first to speak out if he did. That is the Celtic striker, of course. And it's a heavy toll on Tiger Roll. Tiger Roll must shoulder the very, very unfair burden of top weight. And it remains an if he runs the English Grand National on April the 4th.
I thought there'd be more Tiger Roll puns this morning, but there aren't any. The back page of the Mirror as well. Sorry, the other story is Sancho scrap. Dortmund ready to sell England kid for up to £120 million. And United and Chelsea are set to slug it out. Who's going to get him? Who should get him? Who would you sign for if you were Jadon Sancho?
Manchester United or Manchester City? Is that the question?
No. You're Jadon Sancho.
Liverpool.
Your phone is hot right now. You can phone anybody.
You sign for Liverpool Football Club.
Where are you going to play?
Well, are we going to assume that Liverpool might at some point in the next 24 months lose one of their magic three up front?
Why would you assume that?
Will Real Madrid come in with some sort of unbelievable offer for one
who?
Of them? And like, will they say to themselves, you know, actually we want to go become a Galactico, Sadio Mane potentially. Now, does Jadon Sancho potentially fit in better in the Mo Salah role on the right? Possibly. But if you're picking a football club that you want to play for at the moment, it's Liverpool, and you're giving yourself a chance to say, maybe at the end of next season, probably not at the end of this season, but the end of the next season, there might be a possibility where this team starts to get broken up a bit. It happens to all great teams.
Well, exactly. So do you want to be the one, do you want to be the one Sebastian Varane who breaks up the Manchester United team for a couple of years and leads to nothing happening? Do you want to be...
Yes, you do. Except be just a better version of Varane.
Do you want to be Griezmann at Barcelona who comes along and everything goes to shit?
Yes, but a better version of Griezmann in that situation. Like, obviously, you can't really blame everything on Antoine Griezmann. I mean, maybe you can blame it, as Eric Abidal said, maybe you can blame it on the work ethic of the players and their distaste of the manager.
Do you join a team that's already at the absolute peak? So, say for example, right, Liverpool win the Champions League again this year. That'll be second in the league in the Champions League, first in the league by record number of points and a Champions League. How does it ever get any better than that? It never gets better.
You're literally say the same.
Lately, I got the feeling that I came in at the end.
They could say the same.
I mean, you could win more trophies in Champions League every season. Like, but that's not going to happen. So do you not want to go to Man United and rescue an entire club? Be the, like, be that messianic figure. Be the new Eric Cantona. Imagine that.
Because Eric Cantona obviously pulled the wreckage from the water. Like, I mean, there are very few examples of these players who would go to a club and single-handedly turn it around. Like, Manchester United have tried to do this. Like, was Paul Pogba not going to be this figure that was going to turn the fortunes around, get the club back on track post-Alex Ferguson? There's been plenty of these signings that have happened. I think it's just a far riskier move if you're a young footballer to go and try and join a club like that. Now, that being said, a Marcus Rashford, Jadon Sancho attack would be something that you would certainly watch. The post-Ighalo years would probably be a bit more positive.
Yeah, like you're exactly. Did you say Ighalo?
Yeah, the point, like, I mean, we're living in the Ighalo era, of course.
Right now, yeah.
When you judge Manchester United's attack.
And so you're replacing him, or you're replacing Sadio Mane in 18 months' time after kicking your heel on the bench and losing your form.
Well, there is a lot of truth that you're certainly coming from a low baseline, but do footballers actually set themselves low baseline targets?
Could you sign for Man City and replace Aguero? And actually be the thing that gets them over the line in the Champions League?
No, you couldn't. Like, he's not the sort of player to replace Sergio.
But, like, so you're the totemic leader of that team. Or will Kevin De Bruyne suddenly take over?
I think going to Manchester City is a bit of a different prospect. Like, he would look at someone like Leroy Sané and his
crapping out.
Yeah, like the way things haven't ended up amazingly well for him at Manchester City, and think to himself, how much better am I than Leroy Sané? So, like, I see your point, but I think that if there's an opportunity to join Liverpool and there's an idea that one of the big three is going to be leaving at the end of the 2020-2021 season, then you go to Liverpool, and sure, they may have won back-to-back Premier Leagues by then, but it's still a better position to be.
Club burns out and then there's a new decade of darkness in your
life. But this is the sort of player that would revitalise and re-energise Jurgen Klopp had he needed that.
You definitely, like, you'd be having conversations with Klopp where you'd need to get to the point of him trusting you to tell you the truth, right? Because, like, you know, you're going to a new gig and you ask the person who's there, how long are you staying? Like, oh, I'm staying forever. And then 6 months later, they're out the door. But if you can sit down with Klopp and go, look, are you Alex Ferguson or are you Jose Mourinho? Are you Alex Ferguson or are you Pep Guardiola? Because if you're Pep Guardiola and you're fecking off to hang around New York for 18 months...
Go join Juventus.
Whatever. Then I'm not interested. Because I want somebody now... This stage of my career is the bit where I become the best footballer in the world. That's my ambition if I'm Jadon Sancho.
Unless,
right?
You go halfway through and you go with the Chelsea option. And you think to yourself, right, okay, what are the players that they've got at their disposal. They've obviously made a big move with Christian Pulisic last year, bringing him into the club. Like, do I follow the way of another former Dortmund man and try and revitalise his attack in the post-Hazard era? Like, it's not as grim as Manchester United, but it's nowhere near as
exciting as Liverpool.
Like, exciting trophy-wise. But then again, does the excitement come from the possibility of bringing this team up to the top? Like, I can see your point on that. I just don't think Manchester United is the place to do that, because there is no guarantee whatsoever that they will actually be the team that surges up. However, what if Mauricio Pochettino is the guy having the conversation with Jadon Sancho? That transforms everything.
It does, doesn't it?
And if we are saying that this will maybe be something that might happen at the end of next season, although by the way it's looking, it could be this summer, then you might have a better idea of the direction United are going in. If United were in Chelsea's league position right now and trending the right way and had Mauricio Pochettino as manager, I would say, yes, Sancho, this looks like a project that you could possibly join. But you just don't know where Manchester United are going to be in a year. Like, we've said this in so many times, like, during Moyes, during Van Gaal, during Jose Mourinho, give them a year and they'll be fine.
No, he didn't.
We've said, just a new manager, no. Jose Mourinho, he's got about 4 weeks left.
They were all the wrong managers at the wrong time.
Because we suspected that Mourinho will be gone, Pochettino will be installed, give him a year, and then United will be on the right road. We are here a year later at this point, over a year later, and Manchester United haven't got any better. So I wouldn't be absolutely rubber stamping this turnaround for Manchester United that it's going to happen anytime soon. Although, if you just, you know, sensibly appoint Mauricio Pochettino at some point before the time next season starts, then they might actually be in a better place.
Yeah, so, okay. We'll wait and see exactly what happens. But Jadon Sancho has a big decision to make, apparently, because he's on the market. Back page of The Guardian this morning. Fit for the future. Crisis at UK Athletic under review after major concerns. And then Jeepers Keepers is the headline on the goal that Leeds conceded last night. Leeds cling on to second place after fighting back at Brentford on a night to forget for Championship Keepers.
Red Hot Hogan sends out message to Mick. It's a photograph from him scoring for Birmingham City last night. And Park Strife is the headline by Mark Gallagher here. Tab of the morning to you.
Good headline.
Report reveals Cork's €31.5 million stadium debt.
Friends reunited. And it's a picture of Chilwell, Madison and Grealish on their break. What about me? It's Chilwell saying. They're all in Dubai, are they? Is that what it is?
I'm not sure. Is it Dubai? Yes, it is Dubai, sorry.
I mean, I was just guessing.
Manchester United are in Dubai. I don't know where the three boys are.
Right.
I've already put them down as United players, clearly.
Solskjaer has both Madison and Grealish, but he will have to splash £160 million for the pals. So that's the two lads and Jadon Sancho. Could they all play in the same team?
The three lads and Jadon Sancho, or the two lads?
Two lads.
Okay, so let me think. So you've got Grealish, Madison, Rashford, Sancho. What is it? A 4-2-2-2?
Is it a good team?
It would be a good FIFA team. It would be a great FIFA team.
Could it be like a tiki-taka? Would they be amazing?
I think it would be a bit more energetic than tiki-taka.
So Scott McTominay, who's the new Roy Keane, according to the Man United fans.
Beside Bruno Fernandes.
Yeah.
Who likes to score a goal himself.
And then you've got...
Grealish and Madison. And Rashford and Sancho up front.
Yeah, it's not bad, is it? Not very wide. You're asking a lot from your fullbacks. But Aaron Wan-Bissaka's a good athlete.
And Chilwell could be your new left back.
He's staying in Dubai.
Okay, he's there forever. That would be like they could just go full banter era and make those signings and just say, listen, we're going to be attractive and we're going to lose a lot of games.
They could afford this.
6-2.
They could afford that. If you sell Pogba, you can afford that. Like It's only the Sancho money and a bit more.
Like, it's this idea that those teams are kind of too attack-minded, holding clubs back from actually signing them. I would like to think that there's a better midfield option that they need to get before they start splashing into the attack market. But then, like, if Anthony Martial is, when everybody's fully fit, your focal point of your attack, you probably do need to make a new signing because he seems to have stalled.
You'd sell him for whatever, 40 million? Will you get 40 million for him?
Yeah, I think you would. If somebody's stupid enough to stump it up this summer. Like, wait a little bit longer and you might get them at a cheaper price. Daily Telegraph is united by MND. So this is Stephen Darby, Rob Burrow and Dolly Weir on their battle against disease. And Championship clubs slam RFU cash cuts. Second-tier sides accused Twickenham of ring-fencing the Premiership.
Right, 7:57 this morning here for you. We've got Paul Rouse and Stephen Ferris joining us here on OTBAM in the next hour. First, we want to bring you an update on George Gibney, the former Irish swimming coach who's been accused with 27 counts of indecent assault and unlawful carnal knowledge before he escaped conviction in the 1990s following a Supreme Court ruling in 1993. This is a story we've been covering for the last couple of years. Gibney is currently believed to be residing in Florida and there have been some new developments. Irvin Muchnick is an investigative journalist who's been working on this story for years. Here's the very latest on Gibney.
Yes, I mean, we kind of have it surrounded now. We have everything except the shoe dropping. We know that there's a federal grand jury in New York, and in the American justice system, grand juries work with prosecutors to figure out whether persons and entities should be indicted for crimes. It's a kind of preliminary phase of a case. But the fact that there's a grand jury investigating USA Swimming for financial impropriety and insurance fraud and cover-ups of sexual abuse cases in the United States is related to the Gibney matter. And the Gibney matter, as I've been saying for years, is a global issue, not just the story of individual coaches in Ireland who needed to be thrown under the bus and in some cases thrown into prison. So this grand jury has been operating through all of 2019. It's been reported by the Wall Street Journal and other prominent American newspapers. But what hasn't been reported is the related George Gibney aspect of the investigation, which I know has been happening for at least the last year. And I've now confirmed the office at the Department of Justice headquarters in Washington, D.C., that is working on the Gibney matter. It's called MLARS, which stands for Money Laundering and Asset Recovery Section. The person working on it, who I know you don't want me to name, is a longtime corruption prosecutor who joined the federal government in December of 2018. And her title is Human Trafficking Finance Specialist. So it's possible that this George Gibney investigation is related to USA Swimming financial improprieties that are also being probed by the federal government. It's possible that it's just an add-on to the federal grand jury investigation, but I can say with certainty that it's happening. Now, what hasn't happened is an indictment of George Gibney or an extradition order. These things have been happening with other foreign national Olympic coaches who've been living in the United States. A Mexican gymnastics coach in the Chicago area is now in the process of being deported. But it has a wrinkle with George Gibney because he didn't become a citizen. He was denied citizenship in 2010. The reason apparently being, from the records that I've been able to acquire under a Freedom of Information Act settlement with the Department of Homeland Security, the reason apparently being that Gibney lied on his citizenship application about whether he had ever been charged with a crime. And that disqualified him from getting a successful citizenship application, but in a bureaucratic odd situation or wrinkle, the ICE office in the United States, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ruled that he could not be removed from the country because he had not been convicted of a crime.
Okay. Right, okay.
So there's a whole bunch of things we can discuss surrounding all that.
OTB
AM. Brought to you by Pandora. Celebrate love with a special gift.
3 minutes past eight this morning. You're very welcome along to OTB AM. If you just joined us, Paul Rouse is going to join us to talk to us about the Director General's report and also about what we should be looking for when it comes to the political powers and parties over the next while when it comes to the Department of Sport. Stephen Ferris is going to join us. We'll talk about the back rows with him a little bit later on. But the top five stories that we're covering for you this morning: the GA finances, obviously number one. Joe Brawley, obviously the councillor in Clare, who I think was really looking for a bit of attention, has managed to get it off the back of Brawley's exit from RTE. Tiger Woods has been talking for the first time in a while. We'll come back to that in a minute. Yeah. And four and five for you. Cat's Attack, a few changes, a few little kinks in the armoury that Ireland have been offering over the last couple of weeks, so we can begin to discern Mike Catt's fingerprints. And then Manchester United, what the hell do they do next? Pochettino apparently available. Mm-hmm. Let's start with number one. Finances, or where do you want to go? Tiger?
Let's go to Tiger, okay. Because we haven't really spoken about Tiger this morning. So it's not so much to do with Tiger Woods. This is more to do with Premier League golf, which has been something that's been floated over the last month or so. So he's been speaking at the Genesis Invitational this week and has confirmed that he has been approached by the organisers of this Premier League. So basically, for anybody who's missed this, they were outlined last month. 48 players would compete in an 18-event season, offering a total prize fund of $240 million.
18 events.
Now, there's more in this. The tournaments would be 54 holes rather than 72 holes, and there would be an individual and team league format. And then the winner would, the weekly individual winner,
would
claim $2 million of the $10 million dollar purse
every week.
Yeah, but it's actually very simple.
What's the team event?
One less round of golf. I presume it's like the Constructors' Championship in Formula One, where you actually have a team that is.
Team titleist.
Yeah, exactly. But
Scotty Cameron, Team Ping.
So, like, this is obviously going to create a huge inconvenience for the PGA Tour, for the European Tour. And Jay Monahan, who is the Keith Pelly of the PGA Tour, has come out and said that if you're playing that World Tour, you're done. You're not going to be a PGA Tour member. So this is going to reach a bit of a head. I think part of it is actually due to the fact that they want to get more money for the golfers. Like, I always thought the prize money was actually fairly substantial.
Enough,
But this would actually possibly increase the coffers of players like Tiger Woods. So it's very interesting that Tiger is speaking about this very openly. So, like, what he said, have I been personally approached? Yes. And my team's been aware of it and have delved into the details of it and trying to figure it all out, just like everyone else. We've been down this road before with World Golf Championships and other events being started or other tours wanting to evolve. There's a lot of information that we're still looking at, and whether it's a reality or not, just like everybody else, we're looking at it. So this is not Tiger Woods saying this is a ridiculous notion over here, these entrepreneurs in the corner trying to mix up the game a small bit. This is Tiger Woods saying, yes, I am interested in this, we are thinking about this, and let's see what happens. So this is possibly the biggest injection of oxygen that these organisers could possibly hope for. Just being kind of like, so basically the team concept here. So modelled in part, this is from ESPN a couple of weeks ago, modelled in part after Formula One racing, there would be 12 teams of four players each with a season-long competition that culminates in a season-ending event for players and teams. So ESPN are saying how this would be structured, they don't know. But in theory, players or other entities could own teams, which is interesting. The big questions, how would players feed into this tour, into the various teams, and what if a player is injured? So there are questions from ESPN, who obviously have their finger on the pulse quite a bit of this. The answer to your question is about the team thing is we clearly just don't know.
Yeah, it seems like an unnecessary wrinkle, right?
Like, what you have to think then, what would be the idea behind it? Is it...
The point of a Constructors' Championship is essentially that you have these great manufacturers who are trying to use Formula One for marketing and also for the evolution of...
So you're saying titles, but obviously...
Well, so for the evolution of their equipment, right? That was initially what it was supposed to be back in the day. And it's obviously evolved. Red Bull don't really give a shit about their engineering facilities to... That's not how they're making their money. But for Williams, for example, they use that as a way of, like, designing fridges to... be more efficient in supermarkets. Like, there's loads of different ways that Formula One do it. But from a golf perspective, like Team Tiger Woods, is it just to sell my stuff and so that I'll hire Tiger Woods to build my golf course and I'll buy Tiger Woods balls and I'm, like, that's the Nike brand. Is that what it is?
Possibly. Your guess is as good as mine on this.
Does that make sense?
It certainly makes sense from Tiger Woods' perspective. It means that you're keeping all the wealth within your golf world.
And so if you think back to how the US tour exploded with the career of Tiger Woods, and from that time in 97 when he wins the Masters, the explosion of money that comes into it, he obviously made a fortune off the back of that. Now, had to give a lot of it to Elon. But did he get a fair share of that, would you say? Probably not. It might be too late for him. That horse might have bolted, though. He's not going to get that money back. So maybe he thinks there's some way of doing this and he gets a share of the tour. But then, like, why does Brooks Koepka sign up? Why does Rory McIlroy sign up?
Is it for that exact reason? Do you then have Team Koepka and the Brooks Koepka brand becomes this even bigger thing that is, as you say, getting hired to design courses? Or
so say I'm, like, the 36th best golfer in the world, right? Is my ambition to play to make Brooks famous and rich? Or is my ambition to kill Brooks Koepka and, like, win all the money?
Well, you would like to think it's the latter. And
so maybe Brooks Koepka plays for Team Wilson and they are, like, the top four Wilson golfers in the world.
Or maybe it's just, like, Team Red Bull. Maybe it is Team Red Bull and it is just the exact same thing, that it is just a marketing strategy for these massive conglomerates. It doesn't necessarily need to be a golf-linked thing. Now, someone like Tiger Woods is probably rich enough to be able to take on...
Okay, so here's the thing. If you're sitting watching golf, is this a better... I mean, it might be a better... Scrap the team element of it, right? Mm. But having the 54 best golfers, how big is it? 48?
What did I say? 48.
48 players playing 54 holes, so no golf on a Thursday. Who watches the golf on a Thursday anyway? Except for, you know, degenerate gamblers. But a three-day tournament is actually a pretty good thing, right?
Yeah, it would certainly be a lot quicker. And, like, I don't know, the team element would be interesting as well. Like, if you can have the sort of Ryder Cup level of passion between, like, Patrick Reed and Rory McIlroy.
I'm not having it.
Like, if you can...
The team, but the other thing might be better. You just, like, they all commit to play 18 tournaments. You know every week you're going to see all the best golfers. There's no mark. But then how do you become the best golfer in the world if you're not playing against the best golfers? Where do the majors fit in? Go on.
That's a good question. You're asking me a lot of questions I don't have the answer to this morning. Just a quick word on rugby. Gordon Darcy's column, which we'll come back to, I think, later on with Stephen Ferris. a couple of people have been asking, including myself, over the last couple of weeks, are we going to see anything new from Andy Farrell, and what is that thing? And then also, what is Mike Katz's attacking strategy? And Darcy's kind of made a few observations on that over the course of the weekend, kind of based on Jordan Larmour here, who says, who was running the ball, who kept looking for the middle of the pitch. Darcy says, when I saw Jordan and Aki popping up as first receivers on the short side, Mike Katz's coaching was apparent. Sexton hangs in behind the ruck, allowing him to go one way or the other, depending where he thinks the defence is suspect. It also means Johnny is an inside pass option for the first receiver, so that changes his threat to the defences. That's new, he says. What's old is attacking off scrum half, which can still be very effective, and on he goes about that. But this just kind of hammers home the real importance of Johnny Sexton and all of this, that he's been given a more central role in the attacking plan, obviously given the captaincy at the start of the Six Nations, and that we may actually, despite the fact that most people didn't see it coming, we may actually see another act in Sexton's career as an Ireland player where he potentially goes to a new level as a leader on the pitch.
He obviously, his contract is up until the end of the Lions, so he felt he was at least going to make the Lions and be playing well enough to be considered for selection in the Lions. If you were picking a Lions team this week, is he ahead of his main rival for the out half position? Yes.
Of course he is.
Like,
well, assuming you're playing Owen, in placing, that is if you assume Owen Farrell is 12.
Well, no, so let's say Owen Farrell's a 10.
Okay. Well, then you have a decision to make.
Yeah, but it's close enough. It's not like, oh, well, it's Owen Farrell, and then it's miles and miles and miles. So can he make the next World Cup? That's the big question. Let's start talking about a four-year cycle right now. That's what everybody wants to hear, isn't it? These games are irrelevant. What does it mean for our World Cup chances, Owen?
Every time Ireland win a game, we should do 30 seconds on 2023.
You should do your depth chart right now.
But I'll, like,
Harry Byrne's number one in your 2023 team, isn't he?
100% Harry Byrne and Calvin Nash.
Yeah.
They're the boys.
You should be proving your rugby credentials by just naming all the schoolboys who are currently playing for St. Michael's.
Just get up the Ireland under 20 team and name it from under 15.
Yeah.
You're a rugby expert immediately. Just one other thing before we wrap up and get into Paul Rouse. We've got Robert Kitson as well, writing about rugby as well this morning. He's talking about England and their media antics last week. And talking about the general culture around rugby and that it's being tainted a small bit.
What?
He says, abusing the goal kickers, gesticulating at officials, booing players from a rival nation off the bus and blaming the media have become an all too familiar part of the Six Nations backdrop. He talks about former Scotland international Peter Brown writing a thundering letter to the Times last week. Hate is for terrorists, not rugby players. Which of course comes from the England press conference last week where they were talking about Scotland hating us and us hating them. Kitson says, disliking somebody based purely on their nationality is the most blinkered of traits. Such intolerance is nothing to shout about. And then talks about Ellis Genge and dismissing the sausages who aired uncomplimentary views about England after the French game, only to say nicer things post Murrayfield. Kitson says Genge is straying onto trickier terrain. Does he mean only he, Ellis, can tell it like it is? Is he saying the former internationals who are critical of the Parisian performance know nothing? Honestly, at the top level, is a two-way street. And then finally, Johnny Sexton comes into Rob Kitson's piece this morning. Johnny Sexton is surely destined to become the best referee in the world. So often does he lecture those mere mortals currently trying to do the job. There's plenty more stuff in that. It's good.
Kissing your buddy?
No, no. You mean the person who referred to my questions as long-winded? That would be Paul Rees, right. Robert Kitson's colleague, but I don't hold grudges.
No, and you didn't go and accost him in the press room like you were supposed to at the weekend when you spotted him?
God, no. I think he was, to be honest with you, he was totally right in everything he said about me.
Right, okay. There's a big row brewing in English rugby at the minute. The RFU have been accused of giving premiership clubs the ring fencing on a plate. Essentially, they're slashing the funding to the championship teams. This civil war in English rugby is going to be interesting for us all to watch because it has implications for what the future is of the Pro 14, a potential merged Super League, European League, or at least a Lions League, as Keith Wood would always refer to it. We'll get back to that in the coming days and weeks. 15 minutes past 8 here this Wednesday morning. Delighted to say UCD professor and Examiner columnist Paul Rouse is going to join us in studio next here on OTBM. We're going to talk about Tom Ryan. Let's hear from the Director General. Here he is chatting to John Duggan after the release of his annual report about his desire to be more transparent regarding executive pay in the GAA.
There's a lot of talk in Irish sporting discourse about governance at the moment. We had the issues with the FAI. I think there's a very transparent, clear message from the GAA today about where the money's going, where the money's spent, like that is all put back into the association. Do you think or do you intend to publish the salaries of senior staff at the GAA, Tom?
Well, we have actually done that, John. If you have a look through the accounts, you'll see we didn't up to now. We never had any kind of disclosure like that in our accounts before, and certainly we never refer to individuals or anything like that. This year, what we've done is we have identified and disclosed in aggregate the salaries of, I suppose, what you would call the senior management group. So that's a bit of a departure for us. But again, we haven't mentioned individuals. But look, what we've got in the accounts there, I think it's in excess of what we would be required to provide in terms of accounting standards and accounting in terms of the law and so on, all those things. We're conscious of those standards. We're conscious of preparing accounts that are meaningful to users, and they are actually able to get a good handle on what it costs to run the association. So we have expanded on our disclosures this year.
You enjoying the job, Tom? What's your hope for 2020 in Gaelic Games?
Big thing for 2020, I would love to see the fixtures issue making progress. I think the amount of work that went into that over the course of the last 3 to 6 months was phenomenal. And I think if we can arrive at some really, really good changes arising out of that piece of work towards the end of the year, I think that'll be good. And as always, my hope for the year is good matches.
Tom Ryan speaking with John Duggan yesterday at the launch of his annual report. Paul Rouse is here. Paul, let's start with the executive pay because we just played that clip and people will be interested in it. They didn't have to do it, but they did have to do it in a way because that's where we are as a society at the moment, particularly given everything that's done. But fair play to them for coming out. This feels like there's baby steps in the right direction here and towards a more transparent organisation.
This is, I would see it as a landmark report. In the manner in which the GAA conducts its affairs. It's the tone of the report, the content, the manner in which it's organised, the absence of hubris, the acknowledgement of difficulties, and remarkably, a clearly set out vision for what the association should be, succinctly put in half a page rather than the product of a commission's strategic report with external consultants that costs a bomb and nobody reads. I think the whole thing is it's a credit to Tom Ryan and it's a credit to the association. It's not to say that there aren't a couple of problems within the report, but I think it's what you would, if you were a GAA member, it strikes exactly the right tone and has exactly the right content for what you might wish to see.
That's the most positive thing I've ever heard anybody say about an annual report from the GAA.
And you know, it's great to be able to say something positive.
Yeah.
About the manner in which the GAA is run at central level. Now, it's not that there aren't things that need to be done. It's not that there aren't gaps in it, and it's not that there's a clear and absolute definitive plan. The devil will be in the detail in the workings out, but as a document which sets out how the organisation is conducting itself, what it needs to do to fix problems and where it needs to go, I think it's what you look for.
You can't solve a problem if you can't diagnose it.
Clear.
So in a way, like Tom Ryan obviously inherited this gig and there were a number of squalls that kind of blew through the association over the last period of time. This is him now getting to grips with it. This is his organisation. That's his senior management team. This is him properly feet under the table as the person who has the main gig as opposed to just the person who was the finance guy.
Yes.
So this is his first, like obviously, this isn't his first annual report, but it's certainly his first time where he's been able to go, okay, my committees have been in place. I've worked with a president for a couple of years now. I've had this role to the point where I can begin to expand what my vision is. So let's start with that, because that's very interesting to hear you say that.
Finally, there's a confidence about it as well. I mean, he's... And I want to say this clearly, I don't know Tom Ryan. I met him very briefly once at a committee. I didn't ever have a conversation with him. And so I don't have a dog in the fight here, in the sense that I'm not given to him or in any shape or form. But you have to judge it by what you see and by the words that are written and by he lays out. And if you want to start with, he has a page which is 66 pages into the report, which is a logical follow-on of everything that he said before, and he maps it out clearly, what his vision of what the GAA should be, And I can point out a couple of
things. Let's talk about this. So this the page is a sustainable GAA.
It's called the Sustainable GAA, and he sets out 8 points of how he sees the future. Number one, the year is demarcated more clearly with defined rest periods. Number two, the burden on county players' time is lessened with a lower proportion of training to games. Number three, county players play much more regularly for their clubs. Number four, clubs are self-sustaining in that team managers and coaches will come from within a club. Number five, that lessens the financial burden on clubs, which anyone who's involved in a club or in a county understands. All of that lessens the club and the county financial burden. It is hell to be involved as an officer in a club or in a county board at the moment to try and generate finances for the day-to-day operation of that organisation, let alone for capital investment for the future. Number six, the central pressure to drive money is lessened because all of that happens. So therefore, we don't have to squeeze everybody for every penny when it comes to everything else. Number seven, we have better organisational structures. So we have a supported officer base that means it doesn't take over your life if you organise this. And number eight, the burden on volunteers who run clubs and run counties is lessened, and therefore you can actually enjoy it a little bit more. So I think there's one gap in that list of eight, and he alluded to it in his comments there, where he talked about fixtures making progress. Mm. And that, from that I read, the production of a proper calendar of play for adult club players.
I feel like the defined rest periods is kind of
that's a code.
It is for fixtures.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it must include a coherent fixture, club fixtures for things. And in fairness, the new plan for a unit in Croke Park which will assist with this is something that we've been looking for years. So, and he's moving towards it after this Congress.
Is the new unit, sorry, I'm unfamiliar with that concept. So the new unit would be a body, like a full-time professional person who counties can ring up and say, help.
And the devil again will be in the detail in this, but it's also a way of auditing that counties are actually providing a proper fixture calendar for their club players.
Yeah. Because the headline stuff is executive pay, the debt in Porcaquive, the rampant expense that's out of control for running these county teams. They're all symptoms, right?
Yeah.
They're symptoms.
And these are the answers.
And of an organisation that hasn't, up to this point, had a, well, at our core, if we do these things, and we ask the question, does this help with our core business, or are we doing this according to our beliefs? And if the answer is no, then we don't do it. Like, do we have enough support for this infrastructural project in Porcaquive? If the answer is no, well, then we're not doing it until we actually put in place the right committees and structures and professional body.
And this is why I think the report is great, because it is undemonstrative in, and somewhat boring in the sense of those list of things that are fundamental, eight pillars, fundamental pillars. And they're written in very simple English, very clearly put. And he then comes out with a line which says, to me, that's not revolutionary. Now, if he does those eight things, it will revolutionise the operation and the experience of GAA members around the country. If he does those eight things, if he leads, he can't do them himself.
Sure.
Like, if he leads the doing of those eight teams through a proper management structure in Croke Park, which isn't just a director general with a whole flat line of people under him who report directly to him. He needs a coherent management structure over it. He needs a sensible president with him who will assist in driving volunteers around the country in support of him. And if he does those things, this is revolutionary. He says it's not revolutionary, but it is, in terms of how it will transform the association.
How achievable is it?
That is, again, this is the it's not going to be a revolution in the sense that we're going into the GPO and everything's going to be fine after April. That's not what this is. Like, the,
we might have 100 years of difficulty in the aftermath.
There might be partition in the middle of this, but it will be done in stages if it's to be done. And you can see with Congress, with the new fixtures plans, you will see it in the proposals for new championships. But again, it's one thing to set this out. It's another thing to do it slowly. And you can see he's a way of doing things. For example, with rule changes in football and hurling, He talks about nudging the game, and he's really talking about football, nudging the game in a more expansive direction. And I think what he's looking at here is nudging things in a very particular direction.
So, Paul, why do we then have a situation where, and I think fixtures are one of the most important things to be looked at the moment, especially when it comes to these eight facets of Tom Ryan's philosophy, why do we still have a situation where the CPA are looking at the fixtures being brought by Central Council and walking away? Why people who are inside the tent, even temporarily, are saying, no, we're not having this, we actually don't believe in the direction the organisation is going fixtures-wise? Like, I don't understand how that can tally, because, like, on the outside looking in, some of the new fixture proposals looked really good to me. They looked like they might fix calendar issues, whereas we've spoken to the CPA on the show and they've said that actually perhaps these sort of great fixture proposals may not actually meet their end point. They may not actually come to fruition because they might be out there for optics.
That's a really good question. And I think the CPA's position, which I have huge sympathy for, in fact, I agree with the CPA in their diagnosis of what's wrong. It's the product of decades, and in particular the last decade, but decades of neglect of club players. And it has created an anger, which is entirely justifiable and legitimate, about the way in which they've been treated. And again, I agree with that. But it is that thing about it being the art of the possible here. And you have to think about how change comes. If you come in with a vastly radical solution and insist on it being introduced now, I just don't see that happening. I think incremental movement is the only option here. And I don't see... look, this is fairly clear. You give this another 12 months. You give this... it's lined out in his report what he said, what he believes. You give it another 12 months to see demonstrable progress in a particular direction. The proposals from the fixtures committee are not an end in themselves. They can't be an end in themselves. Sure. They're not enough. But as a staging post, if they indicate a direction of travel, then I will take the best of those, right? Once they've been worked out. But it's not an end point. It has to be a direction of travel.
And I guess that has to take into account then the Tier 2 Championship as well, which obviously has been brought in under Tom Ryan's stewardship. Yeah. Like, obviously you can't attribute everything to the Director General when there are other people working in this, but it has happened under his watch. Like, if the Tier 2 situation is a Tommy Murphy situation again, like, does that not kind of make a huge problem of a few of these 8 points that he's made?
So I have two fundamental problems with the report, and I have a fundamental problem with the Tier 2 Championship, which I think is not a good proposal. I don't think it's well worked out. I don't think it's been properly thought through, and I don't think it fixes anything. So I fundamentally disagree with Tom Ryan on that. What I'm talking about here in this is the broad thrust of where he's going with the association.
Isn't the whole issue of Tier 2 the problem with the structures that we have in the GA, and that was the President's idea, and Tom Ryan can't say we're not doing it because actually the President brought it in, he was elected, and the Politburo can't say no, this is going to be a failure. They have to do their best to try and make a success of it.
And as we know, in any organisation which relies so heavily on volunteers, where there's a volunteer section meets a kind of a permanent civil service section, there is always tension. And working out the structure in that, nobody has cracked it on this one. It's a really difficult thing. It's a really difficult thing to work out. And again, I have yet to meet anybody, I've yet to meet anybody who thinks the Tier 2 proposal, as set out, is an end game in itself.
Yeah.
Or we'll fix anything.
Yeah, I agree with you. But what if in 5 years' time we're looking back at what... or 10 years' time, we look back and go, what John Horan did was introduce the concept of Tier 2 to counties who up to that point had been, and players who were staunchly resistant of it. They fixed those structures when they flipped the seasons, and we now have a league in summer, and the championship is actually, the provincial championships are essentially the first competition of the year, and they're run off in a month, and then we've got 2 months of time for clubs to take over, and then there's this short league season, which is 12 weeks, and everybody goes, wow, that's amazing, and there's three divisions. Then the whole Tier 2 and Tier 3 thing was just a backdoor introduction to that. Everybody would be happy with some kind of solution around that, I think.
I've heard that argument, and I can see the logic of it. personally, I don't think that people within the GAA are incapable of grasping the idea of a tier two situation, and they don't need to see it made real in front of their eyes to understand.
Fair enough.
That it can be.
We
introduced.
Didn't need this.
We didn't need it.
We could have gone straight.
We
needed.
We came at this the wrong angle.
Yeah.
The stuff that needs to be done around calendar is much more important. The stuff that needs to be done around fixtures is much more important. The stuff that needs to be done around finance and organisation, they will allow the construction of other things, not the other way around.
You would say, in fairness to Tom Ryan, the whole point about the fixtures committee, which had the CPA in the tent, which had the GPA in the tent, was that they were getting there. In the meantime, the elected representatives were like, I need a tier two championship, lads, let's go. And so that came in. It was almost like, really? We've got this little thing going on over here which might solve all of our problems. Can we just wait and see how this goes? And it was like, no, we're getting tier two now. So
I have a boring answer to that, and the boring answer is that I actually don't know what happens inside in Croke Park. I don't know if that's what the dynamic was. You may very well be right, but to me, it was the wrong way of doing it.
Yeah, okay.
Tom Ryan made a very valid point yesterday that these out-of-control inter-county costs are hampering other areas of expenditure within counties, yeah, in terms of coaching, in terms of grassroots.
Let me play the video of that, because actually that's interesting. He's here talking with John Duggan. Here is Tom Ryan talking about the level of spending by inter-county sides, saying it's unsustainable.
We haven't cracked that. There was a period 3 or 4 years ago when that cost appeared to be, if not coming down, at least it appeared to be capped. It's increasing again. And it's not really sustainable. I mean, the sheer amount of pressure that it puts on counties financially is unsustainable, and the pressure it puts on county officers individually as volunteers to both bring in that funding, to make sure that funding is deployed to the best effect within counties. The sheer amount of stress, hassle, pressure that it puts on all of us is not sustainable. We need to address that.
Yeah, so like the point on the back of that being that, like, I always thought that, say, inter-county costs, they can run away as far as they want, and they are siphoned off, and it's actually a ridiculous notion. Of course, it's coming from other areas within county boards, and, like, the question is, how do you actually stop this? And Tom Ryan is the first person there to say that, I don't know, like, how do you stop this situation of, what is it, 32 million quid being spent in inter-county teams alone last year?
Now, if anybody believes there was only 32 million euros spent on inter-county teams last year, they have a relationship with finance, which I would love to see their personal bank accounts as a spectacular work of fiction. They must be. There was way more than 32 million spent on inter-county teams, and that's just in the current expenditure. Look at the capital expenditure for the infrastructure to allow the inter-county game generate the money, which is never included in this spend. So, for example, we have the headline figure of almost 100 million euros on Páirc Uí Chaoimh, with an outstanding debt of more than 20 million, which is never factored into the costs of the running of the inter-county game and everything around it. But what we're looking at here, of course, is opportunity cost as well, and the fact that if you spend money on one thing, you can't spend it on other things. Or if you invest time generating the money for this, you can't spend the time generating the ideas which will actually do the things that are needed to be done in each county. And again, boring point, but it comes down to calendar. Look at the amount of counties that were back training in October for pre-season competitions that began at the end of November, for a season that will end at the end of August for certain counties. Like, how, in what rational universe does that make sense? I mean, it makes sense if you are a person who is given to that and who has a job out of it and all of that, but that's a whole load of expense and time within an association which is devoted to something that is particular to the needs of a very small few. And that's not sustainable.
Every training session ends up costing a fortune because you've got to pay the nutritionist and you've got to pay all those professional staff who aren't the volunteers.
Can I tell you something on that? I want to tell you something. I was out in the National Aquatic Centre running magnificently around the pitches out there. I had an hour and I went out to the National Aquatic Centre to the sports grounds around it. I think it was February of last year, the annual run. And I go out and I was running around and I saw these, I think there was Lee Keegan. It was a Wednesday night. It was a Wednesday night before Dublin played Mayo in the league in Croke Park. And Mayo had come up and trained, because there were so many players based in Dublin, they'd come up and they trained in the National Aquatic Centre. There were more than 30 players out on the field playing a full match, length and breadth. It was a great game. Great game of football.
Right.
There were maybe four players on the sideline.
Internal training session.
Internal training session. And it was being videoed. There were at least 10 support staff around everything. And there was another bunch of players, the Killian O'Connors and that, who were coming back from injury in the gym. So that's a panel of more than 40.
Yeah.
All in Dublin for an evening with all of that involved, and all had to be fed, presumably. And I know that there are volunteers in that thing who don't get paid for anything.
Yeah.
But that is an expensive operation. And that's before, that's a Wednesday night before a league game in February. So what is the story all across the place?
Well, famously, Tipperary needed another bus for their support staff for the All-Ireland final. It was like one for the staff and one for the team. Or at least that's what they said.
Kildare footballers, for a long time, that's the way it was.
Yeah, and it didn't actually end up benefiting them in the long run. Like, I don't know what the Kildare footballing identity is. It seems to be to pay an outside manager to come and, you know, whatever, over the three decades. I'm not singling out the current one. But, like, what is our identity as a football county? Like, who are we? What do we stand for? We stand for a falling down St. Connolly's Park and great underage footballers who then disappear because there's no strategy behind it.
It is one of the great enigmas for anyone who ever sees Kildare club football or goes and plays against Kildare teams and who sees Kildare under 18 and under 20 teams. And the power and pace with which they play, how many skillful quality footballers they produce, the number of club players and the number of schools teams.
Yeah.
And then something happens.
Yeah. And I think that this all comes down to that. And it's like, it's sustainability is actually...
Yeah, it's the key word in this.
Yeah.
And it is a buzzword for the moment, right?
But there's nothing sustainable about getting an outsider to come in for a year and a half, flake everybody and then go away again.
Like, not if you don't have the structures behind it. There is nothing wrong with somebody coming in into a structure that's properly organised. But the idea that this you put in, you do the top layer of the cake first.
And that's it, yeah.
That's just not going to happen.
Yeah, and so Kildare is just a microcosm of what is happening in loads of other counties around the place. Like, so your takeaways are that you're positive about the person who's at the helm and having a vision. What are the other quick challenges that?
Okay, so I want to line out two things. There's a brilliant sentence in this where Tom Ryan takes on the idea of the role of the club, right? And he's a great line on it. He said that he himself believes that this idea of the primacy of the club is more of an aspiration or a statement of intent than an inalienable fact. Inalienable, I can't say that, fact. Now, did you ever think you would see a leading member of the GAA acknowledge the fact that this is an aspiration of a state or a statement of intent rather than an inalienable fact about the centrality of the club? Because, of course, it's a statement of reality that the thing has become skewed. Mm. And it's great to see that set out clearly. Where I absolutely... diverge from Tom Ryan on it is when he talks about the ticket price increases, which were fundamental, by the way, to the rise in revenue.
Yeah.
I know there were more people went to the games, and I suppose he uses that more the fact that more people went to the games to talk about the well-received ticket price increases last year. Now, I've never seen ticket prices for anything well-received.
No.
But these ticket prices last year were outrageous. The increases on them. They, and I'll give you an idea of how outrageous they are. Okay, there was €10 on an All-Ireland final ticket, €5 on a semi-final ticket, €5 on an All-Ireland qualifier, which nobody is going to, €5 on Division 1 and Division 2 football matches. Now, we can say that they're okay in themselves, are not massive. But if you're going with, say there's a couple of you going to a game, that's where you very quickly rack up costs. And the basic fact of it is the All-Ireland final is now 30% more expensive than it was during the Celtic Tiger. And Division 1 league matches are now twice the price that they were. I mean, we fundamentally accept that the country lost a run of itself during the Celtic Tiger. And we're way ahead of them prices-wise.
Yeah.
And there is a myth about the GAA, and the myth of the GAA is sport for all. And the truth of it is, and anybody who's involved in a club in Dublin understands this. It may be slightly different in country areas. But if you're involved in a club in Dublin, you are paying enormous registration fees for that club, to be a member of a club. And in certain areas, you can be looking at, you registering a kid and it's €200 plus. That is not sport for all.
For once they get it out of minis, is it?
Yes. No, grade. No. Once you get into under eights or under tens, it begins to go.
Right.
And it really goes. And the idea, those ticket prices, it is very, very expensive to go to matches now. If you have to travel and do all of that. And it was just a misstep in the middle of to talk about the well-received ticket price increases.
Okay.
There was a couple of other things, like the women's organisation, and their view to whether or not they come inside the organisation or not.
Yeah, and the one club model, 40% of clubs have signed up to the one club model, which basically gives parity of esteem within the club to ladies' Gaelic football, to camogie, and to the GAA. 40% have signed up. Another 40 are on the way to signing up. There is no word of the other 20%. I would love to know what the story is. That 20% of
no,
other clubs.
Not doing it, lads.
Not doing it. And it is that thing. I come back to that point of Sport for All. If it's Sport for All, it wasn't Sport for All for the GAA for many, many, many years because it was Sport for the male all.
Yeah.
But not for women.
For the lads.
Left right. Sport for lads, women left absolutely on the margins. And GAA clubs are being dramatically improved by the ongoing revolution in which sees women take a more central role within the association.
Yeah, and we had the Camogie Association talking about their Manal programme, which is trying to get more female mentors, which is the next wave that's going to actually completely transform how this looks.
Yes, but the Camogie and the Association, I'll take the example of Dublin here, the Camogie and the Association and the Ladies Gaelic Football Association would also want to get their own house in order and get a house in order very swiftly because the manner in which they treat girls in Dublin, for example, is outrageous. And I'll give you an example. In the under 13, under 14, under 15 and so on championships, they set out a calendar of play which means that girls can play football on a Saturday and the following day go out and play a camogie match on a Sunday. And they're set fixtures. League fixtures which matter and championship fixtures which matter week after week. Now there's absolutely no code of best practice which will tell you that that's fine.
Playing a game 2 days in a row.
Yeah.
Right. How do you fix it though? Is it week on, week off? Is that the answer?
Yes, it's really simple.
Right.
Set a calendar of play, sit down, agree it.
Is that
revolutionary?
It is, yeah, it is. That's the thing. It's like getting everybody around the table. But the other aspect of this, which we haven't talked about, is the lands in Clonliffe. So apparently they're going to put the LGFA and the Camogie Association in the same building in Clonliffe beside a couple of pitches. So that in itself might be revolutionary. Everybody's going to be able to walk across the corridor and go, what's your fixtures? Now, that's at central level, so obviously the local level has to filter down. But
these guys know each other already, Ger. This should not be difficult to do. This requires, and it comes down to one basic thing, looking after kids.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that. Look after the kids properly.
We've obviously had a very interesting election over the last while, interesting election campaign. I know you've had a look at all of the manifestos of the various parties. I'd say some of that was hard work and some of it was like, oh, look, I blinked there and I missed that reference to sport in your manifestos. What did you find and what would actually be an ideal scenario at the end of this for where sport sits within the hierarchy of Irish government?
If you look at I read all the manifestos for the all the parties before the election, and it's completely understandable that sport plays a minor part in the manifesto. So we have to be realistic here. While sport is central to our world in very many respects, we also have to say that in the hierarchy of things that need to be done in the country, sport fits into housing in the sense of the provision of sports fields, of playgrounds, of basketball courts and skating parks and everything. Both urban and rural, it fits in to what we need to do with housing. It's dependent on transport to get to very many places. It requires a proper education system which is properly funded and isn't given to granting enormous sums of money to elite fee-paying schools and privileging their needs above everything else. It also has a part to play in health. So sport fits kind of everywhere. But in an entity of itself, it is given relatively little space. But out of these manifestos, there is the makings of a reasonable policy and a reasonable idea. And you can see the ideologies of the various parties and their differences coming out in the things. Like the Greens, for example, want to promote youth and child-friendly water sport to encourage awareness of our maritime heritage. That's one of the things that, that the Greens want to do, as you would expect. And they want to, they have four basic principles for their sport policy: improving health, developing communities, enhancing social inclusion, and participating in nature. And it couldn't be a Green manifesto without saying this. And I have to admit, I agree this, and it's going to drive sports people nuts. But they're talking about the importance for kids of low stakes participation. And that is that they will encourage limit and to the limitation of scorekeeping and record taking and all of that. Now, that's fine to a point.
Yeah.
It's fine to a point. There needs to be a mixture of both that and seriously competitive sport, because kids love competition too. You can't just give everybody a medal. Like, it just doesn't...
No, but the kids know. Like, they end up competing within the games.
Exactly.
Even when there's no score cap, they keep scoring themselves. So, like...
But the point of it is to create a sporting or recreational culture.
Yeah.
Where if you want to play...
There's competition over there. There's no competition here. Everybody does this, and you can all go over there if you want to.
And you're and you're not just standing in a tracksuit running on with the water for somebody else. That's so that principle. I agree, but the Greens don't really have any policies beyond a broad statement of desire.
This is we'll fill this bit in later.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not central to what they wish to do. Solidarity, People Before Profit, want more physical activity in schools. They want better fruit and veg in schools. They want to create, and this is where we get the ideological part, they want to create more publicly owned gyms and pools, and I fundamentally agree with that. But the reality of it is, if councils aren't able to build houses at the moment, they're not building gyms and pools. What I would argue is that when in the new building, which is now inevitably going to happen, in local areas, that publicly owned gyms and pools and recreational spaces,
apartment complexes,
like they talk about the importance of tracks around the place and of skate parks and of playgrounds and having funds for that, and that's exactly right. It's exactly right. The best part of Fianna Fáil's manifesto, I would argue, the best part of their entire manifesto in terms of how it's set out and what it's done is their anti-gambling, or their proposals for taking on gambling, and every single party would do well to take on what they wish to do. They wish for the establishment of a
commission,
a gambling regulating commission, exactly, and just sort out this issue of when you can gamble, how you can gamble, how you can look at how companies deal with problem gamblers and everything to do with that world, which is entirely regulated, unregulated.
Yeah,
not entirely unregulated, but it's largely unregulated.
Yeah. Some of their proposals suggested, it seemed to me, was going to be driving you to use accounts from... See, it seemed that there was a way to circumnavigate some of the issues that they were coming up with. So the gambling regulator, if there is going to be one, needs to have proper teeth.
Yes.
So you can't just say, look, you can't sign up to accounts that are based on servers in Ireland. You can do the same thing on a server in Malta or Gibraltar. And so
yes.
It just needed to be thought through to that next level, I thought.
Yes, absolutely agree, but it was the best of anything that anybody came out with. It was the largest step forward of anything, and I agree, and people will always find ways around this.
Yeah.
But it was a starting point. They did talk about a sports capital programme and a playground fund and 25 million extra spending in schools, which it's very hard to disagree with, but you have to pay for it.
Yeah.
Labour Party talked about using a new betting levy to fund investment in sport. The Labour Party did what was obviously the thing that nobody wanted anyone to do, in that they actually offered costed serious proposals and thoughtful proposals on what you could do, and it went, they just, like everything they did, they should have just clearly picked a number out of the sky and run with it, because that seems to be the way things work. But they actually worked on how they should do it. They had coherent proposals for women participation in the governing bodies of sporting organisations, and most importantly, they talked about the reorganisation of government departments and the creation of a better structure where sport would sit. Mm. Why does sport sit with transport and tourism beyond the fact that it's an afterthought? And in the last government, it was so clearly an afterthought when you had a government minister who was not in any way... Now, it's not clear that he knew anything about transport or tourism either, but he certainly knew nothing about sport and how it would operate, and he had no interest in it really when it comes down to it.
Yeah.
And you're left with a junior minister, and to be a junior minister in a senior department is just...
Pointless.
well, where are you going?
Yeah.
So Labour Party proposed the introduction of communities, art and tourism, arts, heritage, community development, all of that within one department. And that just seems to me to make sense. It's a new government department which goes across all of these various strands. It seems to me to make more sense. And I think that's one thing you could take from the Labour Party manifesto, is that broader structure. Now, the Sinn Féin manifesto talked about increasing spending on sports and recreation, increasing the sports capital programme, and then talked about sport, the importance of sport in a post-conflict revolution society, which was kind of interesting. And it made nice noises around class and gender and geography. And it probably focused more of all on what it called working with all sports bodies to support the creation of all Ireland teams and leagues wherever possible. And it also wants to support elite athletes. Now, in none of this, there's aspiration set out and no plan. Just, and that's fine. It's a manifesto. It's fine to a point. But this idea of supporting all Ireland teams. So what are the non-all Ireland teams?
Football.
So how do you do that?
Seize the six counties, roll your tanks on the lawn in Windsor Park. Is that it?
Well, I'm asking this as a serious question.
Right.
I am asking this as a serious question. And my serious question is this. If you want a United Irish soccer team, or you want a United Ireland in general, what does that look like? And how do you get there?
We've got like 30 seconds left here, and you've just asked the biggest, most fundamental question that we have been unable to answer as a country for 100 years. What does it look like? It looks like building some shared understanding. It means building a trust with people who fundamentally don't trust us, and not being triumphalist when you get that moment of power. It means not shouting up the rat the first opportunity that a camera is put in front of you. It means not lying about that afterwards, like, oh, I didn't realise we were being... Like, it's that kind of stuff. It's explaining the fundamentals of what it means to be Irish without defining us as not British. It means, like, these are the shared heritage that we have almost exactly the same DNA with a tiny little kink that's different, and yet that's the bit that separates us. It means not concerning ourselves with the difference between transubstantiation and whatever the other thing is. Like, none of that stuff actually matters. It means being friends with your neighbours. That's that for me, and building an Ireland off the back of that, and then saying, let's play football together.
That took you a little bit more than 30 seconds, which is a bit disappointing with you, but it is exactly right. And how does singing "Come Out Ye Black and Tans" help create an All Ireland soccer team? How does it help create a United Ireland? If there is a United Irish soccer team, what is the emblem on the jersey? What is the anthem that is played beforehand? What is the flag that is flown before matches? What does any of this look like? And how do you intend to get there? Or is it simply a numbers game?
It's very interesting. We had Cormac Moore in a couple of months ago talking about his new book about partition. And he said that actually what it came down to in the splitting of the two football organisations was actually internal politics rather than the politics of the country, which is kind of very fitting with the last year we've had with the FAI and all the internal politics there, that perhaps the most complicated issue is once you take Jura's ideal on a United Ireland, is actually getting through and wading through the mud of the internal politics that exists and the clinging onto power in the IFA and the FAI that I'd imagine would exist.
Well, I agree with that to a point, but it was all the context is the wider political context. So it's not just that the people don't get on. Like, why did... By the way, the GAA, like, for rugby is an All-Ireland organisation, but for huge swathes of the country for a long time until professionalism, rugby had no relevance because it was associated with a very particular class or professional things. Yeah. The GAA is an All-Ireland organisation once you're of a very... but not if you're loyalist.
Yeah.
So the GAA has a lot of work to do itself. And it is doing work, in fairness, but it's a lot of work to go.
Yeah. All right. Look, we are out of time. Is there one last point you want to make on the manifestos?
I would say that even if you do all of this, the relationship with Sport Ireland has to be clear what you are trying to do here.
And who's in charge.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, Paul, that's great. We'll definitely come back to that. What would a United Ireland football team look like and how we might get there in the future. Right, Irish rugby captain Ciara Griffin joined Joe last night and spoke about the enjoyment she gets from working on her parents' farm. Have a look.
Life generally, so primary school teacher as I understand it, and helping out on the beef farm as well.
and being captain of Ireland, that's fairly fairly full schedule. How's all that going?
All good now. Yeah, no, I'm very lucky. Look, I'm very fortunate. I'm a primary school teacher there in the CBS Primary in Tralee, and look, they're really supportive of me.
Yeah.
It's great to have that support network around you. Mom, like my family at home, they're excellent. Mom, dad, my sister's partner, Damien. Look, they always have you. They back you 100%. That's great, because I think it's once you have that support unit around you, everything else is so much easier. Mm. You know, all the day's training, it's just, it's all worthwhile, because they know what you're training for, they know what your end goal is, your target is. So, yeah, so you have to balance a lot of time and everything, but you'd only be getting bored if you weren't busy.
Well, so, that's true.
It's nice to stay busy.
And is it your parents' beef farm?
Yeah, it's my dad's farm. So dad's a beef farmer here in Kerry in Ballymac. So whenever I get a chance, obviously, during Six Nations at times now, I don't get to go out on the farm as much as I want. But any chance I can, I try to give a hand.
Yeah, probably a very enjoyable thing. Like most of us are removed from nature in any great way. I'd say a bit of time on the farm away from a hectic life with Ireland or even in the classroom must be a chance to almost take a breath.
Oh, yeah, it's amazing. I've always said it. It's a form of mindfulness being out on the farm. It's a way for you just to literally switch off and focus on what you're doing, because whatever task is in hand, that's what you're focusing on right there and right now. So it's a great way kind of to, I suppose, distract you from outside influences or maybe outside issues that you're thinking of or things like that. So it's a great way of just switching off and just totally unwinding. It's really satisfying.
Yeah, that sounds absolutely amazing. Maybe, you know, we need to tap in more to our farming community for rugby players. It's worked out pretty well in the past, right? I think we can all agree as a profession, they're all doing particularly well when it comes to playing rugby. Right, it is 8:57 this morning. It's Valentine's week. OTBAM has partnered up with Pandora to solve your needs. I know you need this. Don't pretend you don't. You can find the perfect gift this Valentine's Day with Pandora. We're here to give you a guide to some of the great options. You can check out pandora.net for all the details. But for your complete gift guide, myself and Adrian Barry, resident OTB romance correspondents, went to Pandora on Grafton Street this week to find out what it's all about.
OTB
AM. Brought to you by Pandora. Find the perfect gift this Valentine's Day.
Look, let's face it, we all need some help from time to time. That's why this week here at OTBAM, we've teamed up with Pandora to bring you some advice about what you should actually do on Valentine's Day for the love of your life.
I'm useless with this stuff. Absolutely useless. I forget dates, forget anniversaries, forget all sorts of stuff. So I think that Emma's going to talk us through a lot of the options here today.
I don't know if you're going to be able to be helped, though. You're like a bit of a lost cause.
No, it's true. If anybody's up for the job, I think Emma's up for the job.
They've got some experts. Let's go.
Well, hi guys, how are you?
We need help.
Okay, do you need help with?
Well, I mean, existentially,
issues, but, yeah.
The specific one at hand is what the hell do we? So today's Wednesday, right?
Yeah.
We've got 2 days left to play with. Something simple.
Something
that's not going to go down. We're like, what?
Yeah.
What is this?
I made the mistake of buying my wife's engagement ring before she inside of it.
Disastrous
move. Had to bring it back.
Yeah, you should have come in here.
I should have come in and had a conversation too. Yeah, she brought it back. Yeah.
So tell me a little bit, what does she love?
Something simple. Look, let's face it, right? Yeah. Everybody's a little bit lazy when it comes to our side of this deal.
Yeah.
We just want something that we're going to be able to come back and maybe
return
next year do something. do something.
Hopefully we'll get you something that you don't have to return.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so what have you got for us?
This is Collar Builder Bracelet Range. So what it is the good starting pack. So you get your bracelet and two charms in this range for €139. And then in this deal here, you get again your bracelet and your two charms for €159. So it's something that you can custom made for her. And then over time, you'll never be short of a gift because you can just come back into me and I'll give you a charm.
Right. That's how it works.
Yeah.
What are the charms? Like what?
So this one here you've got. So this is your €159 one. So you've got your sterling silver bracelet. So all the jewellery in Pandora is sterling silver. With your cubic zirconia heart finish. And then this one here, if it is for the wife, the charm says my beautiful wife. And then your interlocking hearts, which could represent the two of you guys or even two children, something like that. And then this one here then is a little bit more simple if she doesn't want something too sparkly or you don't want to mix the metals. This one's all silver. And again, you've got your safety clip on here, so she'll never lose her charms with this on it. And then this here then is her birthstone. So the whole idea with the Pandora rings is that they're stackable rings. So this one is the one that was just launched for Valentine's. It's called a solitaire heart, so it actually is cut in the shape of a heart. So again, it's all sterling silver, hand-faceted cubic zirconia in the centre. Yeah. And then this one here then is your wishbone, so it's like one of your classic Pandoras. Again, all sterling silver with your cubic zirconias. And over time, what you can do with all of these rings...
Ah, that's what you mean. All right, okay.
So you buy them separately, but then you can just kind of build them up over time. So again, if you went with this one, her birthday, you come back into me and I give you this one. Christmas,
I see what you're doing.
I see what you're doing.
Sucking us in.
Great. Thanks, William Abbott. Appreciate that. Thank you.
So hopefully that idiot's guide was useful to you ahead of Valentine's Day this weekend. If you want to show her that you know her, just head over to Pandora.net, check out the hashtag PandoraValentines for more information. You can also get more information on offtheball.com. And if there was nothing in today's installment that floated your gondola, then tune in again tomorrow morning when Emma will have more Pandora goodness to bring your way. Pandora fits all occasions, Valentine's, birthdays, Mother's Day and Christmas. They have an offer on at the moment where you can get a bracelet and a pair of earrings. And apparently some people are using it to sort out this week and then also to be ready for Mother's Day. So double whammy there on.
It looks like you learned a lot.
Yeah, we did, you know.
It's.
I mean, obviously, already an expert in this kind of stuff. you reach a certain stage of your life and you acquire information, you know. For a neophyte like you who needs a little bit of help in this, I should go down and see Emma.
What was Adrian?
Very helpful.
What was Adrian's level of expertise like?
Well, Adrian told the story about buying his wife's engagement ring and she was like, oh, we're getting married, great. I might bring the ring back, though.
So basically you're saying, consult Emma before you propose is...
Yeah, look, the staff were, like, very helpful. They were patient with mugs like us, which is what you need. There are a lot of kind of men wandering in going, can you help me? And of course they can. They're used to people like us wandering in. I made the critical error when we were getting engaged of buying a replacement, like not an actual engagement ring, because I knew enough not to do that, right? But I got like a thing with a big stone on it, which my wife wore around for ages, and then we went to the engagement ring shop and I was like...
That's not as big as...
Not as big. So you want to buy something like little tiny.
Okay, and then upscale.
Cheap and like small, and then everything looks good after that.
Okay. It's good. It's a good tip. You could possibly get a job in that shop.
Maybe. Certainly a little bit of advice if you're planning on popping the question this Valentine's Day. Nathan got engaged on Valentine's Day.
Did he?
Yeah, Adrian went, a bit cliched. We're giving you the chance to win a €100 voucher for Pandora every morning on OTBAM until Valentine's Day. It is all with thanks to Pandora. To enter, just share this morning's OTBAM wherever you're watching. Use the hashtag PandoraValentines and best of luck. We're back talking the 2020 Six Nations with Stephen Ferris right after these.
OTB
AM. Brought to you by Pandora. Show her that you know her.
5 minutes past nine here this morning on OTBAM. You're very welcome. If you just joined us, we've had a brilliant conversation with Paul Rouse about the Director General's report. He's very positive about the majority of what's in the report. And we've also heard from Irvin Muchnick. We'll bring you a bit more from that interview in a few minutes' time about the George Gibney saga. But if Tom Ryan can achieve what Paul Rouse thinks he can, then the GAA is pretty well set up.
In amazing shape and sounds of things, because Paul Rouse, I would imagine, would be the first person to slam a report if he didn't see what he liked in it. It's all about the practice of the really good ideas he has.
Yeah, right. Let's turn our attention to rugby. I'm delighted to say Stephen Ferris is with us this morning. Stephen, good morning to you. How are you doing?
Good morning. All good, thank you.
So the Ireland team are rolling after a tricky first game against Scotland, but an excellent performance against Wales. Plenty for the coaching ticket to work on as well at the same time. It wasn't all one-way traffic, but what's your two games in report card looking like for the new coaching ticket?
Yeah, I think after the first game, Jared, it was pretty difficult to say you know, what Andy Farrell was working on and what combinations he was looking at and, you know, how this team had evolved. And I think that's so, so difficult for everybody to kind of judge Andy Farrell on one game. Now, after two games, I think what personally, in my opinion, what I've seen is a little bit more of letting the guys go out and express themselves, given, you know, the likes of Jordan Larmour, Stockdale, Conway, responsibility, and just going out there and playing rugby and playing heads-up rugby at times. And it was brilliant to see. I think even in the Scotland game, Jordan Larmour made a lovely outside break, really hard work rate in the centre of the pitch, and put one of the wingers away. I can't remember who it was. But, you know, when was the last time we seen Rob Kearney do that in a green jersey? And then he followed it up the following week against Wales when he said, give me the ball. I'm going to make something happen. He used his pace, used his ability, step back on the inside. And that's just what Ireland, for me, in my opinion, have been missing slightly over the last couple of years. But, yeah, I think, you know, the ball is rolling now. It was a bit of a shaky start. You know, every fan that I met walking into the Aviva Stadium against Wales was nervous, you know, just because of that performance against Scotland. But I think the lads done everybody proud and put in a performance that we could be, you know, we could say this is the kind of the footprint for Ireland moving forward. This is a blueprint of the way we want to play. So real positivity, Ger.
It's obviously going to be a very different scenario and more difficult job against England. Our pack was able to really break even and be a bit more than break even against Wales. Their pack, the English pack, is much stronger. They talked about brutality. That's supposed to be the team's identity at the moment. They've got a 6-2 split in the subs bench as well. So what's that physical challenge going to be like for Ireland, and how do we measure up?
Yeah, well, I think the physical challenge in the first game against Scotland really set us back a little bit. They starved us of good quality possession. They brought an intensity to that match that I think shocked Ireland a little bit. And that's something that they would have talked about in the lead up to that Wales game. And now even more so in a couple of weeks' time or 10 days' time coming into the English game. So, yeah, we all know what England are going to bring. Eddie Jones has talked his team up on several occasions. They've got the athletes. For me, I would personally like to see England play with a specialised number 8. I think Tom Curry, Underhill, Ludlam, it's all well and good running around and having 3 sevens on the pitch, but I think you need that ball carrying presence. And Billy Vunipola certainly missed. But, you know, you go to Twickenham, I've been there. You know, the lads have been there, won a Grand Slam there. It is a tough place to go, and you know what you're going to get. So they're going to have to raise the physicality stakes. You know, no more soak tackling. I think the average percentage of tackles at the weekend was just over 80% of tackles made. You know, you're going to have to be up into the 90s if you're going to try and win a test match against England.
What about Ireland's back row, Stephen? In Gordon Darcy's column this morning, he's saying Stander who is best suited to blindside. Is that something that perhaps you could see happening and then getting Kellen Dowers back into the team?
I just don't know where all this is coming from, lads. Like, you know, CJ Stander, his best position is number 6. Like, again, walking out of the stadium after the Scotland game, everybody's going to me, I told you CJ Stander was best at number 6. I was like, hold on, guys. He played 76 minutes of the match at number 8. Like, you know, and he played 80 minutes at the weekend at number 8 in the 2-man of the match performances. So I don't know why everybody thinks that CJ's best position is number 8. Trust me, I played number 8 for many a year at underage level growing up, and I played 6 for most of my international career. There isn't that much difference. There really, really isn't. You know, holding slightly in the blind side when it comes to defensive plays, controlling the ball a little bit at number 8. Yes, you might jump slightly more in a line-out, especially if you're somebody like Peter O'Mahony who has that great attribute to his game. But apart from that, you're still ball carrying, you're still making your tackles, and you're still leading from the front. And I think that's what all back rows have got to take into consideration. So I would probably disagree with Gordon Darcy on that one. And at the minute, if you have CJ Stander in your team, you know, it's going to certainly help you.
So I guess the question, I think they're trying to find a way to get Kellen Dowers back in the team.
You're not going to
drop Stander, obviously, after the two performances. So essentially this becomes has Peter O'Mahony done enough to keep Kellen Dowers off when Dowers started the tournament as first choice in Andy Farrell's mind anyway against Scotland? So can you drop Peter O'Mahony for Kellen Dowers for the England game?
I tell you what, guys, I was thinking about this. I've been thinking about it a lot over the last couple of days. And I think if I had it went slightly differently for Ireland in the last game, you could have said, Dowers, no problem. Let's bring him back in. Let's move CJ back to number 6. That wouldn't upset things that much. But Pete played bloody well. And, you know, it's hard to change a winning team, especially a team that gave Wales a bit of a drumming. And, you know, the physicality and that enforcer that Pete brings. Maybe you need a character like that in the dressing room, not just on the pitch, but in the dressing room in the lead up to this big match against England, because we all know it's everything for England. You know, if they don't win this, it's completely bust. Where Ireland, you know, I think can take a bit more out of it. So for me, I think personally that Andy Farrell will go with Peter O'Mahony and have Dowers on the bench.
In terms of other young Leinster Tyros who've been kind of struggling with injury recently, Ronan Kelleher was expected to start at hooker in the Six Nations. Rob Herring, though, like Peter O'Mahony, has done bloody well over the first couple of weeks. He holds on to that hooker jersey, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think he does. I think he's been pretty good. The line-out's been exceptional in the first couple of games. I know there's been a couple of scrappy ones, about 100% there at the weekend. The scrum was a concern against Scotland, and I was asked the question a few times, how much difference does Rory Best make in there with his experience? We all know he can't button his shirt up because his neck is so bloody big. So, he definitely brings that raw strength when it comes to scrummaging. But I think Rob Herring has been superb. Question marks over his Ulster line-out throwing. Him and Ian Henderson haven't really worked this season when they've been wearing a white jersey, but it's all coming together in a green jersey. And Keller, geez, he's exploded onto the scene. I think he made his debut for Leinster only in April 2019, scored a hat-trick against the Ospreys, backed it up, scored another couple of tries for the next couple of weeks, and then all of a sudden you're into Europe and he scores in his European debut against Benetton, and he's just, one of these lads that he's now built up a really good reputation. And I think he's just biding his time, and that's exactly the thing he should be doing. He's only a 22-year-old man. His chance will come, but he's certainly got all the talent. He's a physical athlete that I always love having in my team. But I tell you what, Rob Herring's playing some good rugby also.
It's a great scenario for the Ireland coaching ticket at the moment to have two players, both of whom they can trust. And it's actually probably even better to give Herring a bit of rope here so that he can develop into somebody who is truly international class. And then all of a sudden you've got a proper competition. Was Herring always this good, or is he actually stepping up? Has he surprised, obviously you see him week in, week out. Yeah. Has he surprised you a little bit how well he's done? Because he's been very good.
No, he hasn't surprised me, Ger. I've obviously been in squads with him. He was around Ulster when I was there. A really good fellow to have around the squad. And I think his performances on the pitch for Ulster, he's really led from the front. He's been the captain a number of times over the last couple of years for Ulster also when Ian Henderson hasn't been there. I think Rory Best was obviously number one for so many years with Ireland. And I don't think there was ever somebody like Keller and somebody like Herring playing at the top of his game to ever challenge Rory. And now that, as you say there, Jerry, you have two guys who are battling it out, it's only going to bring the best out of each other. But Rob Herring definitely had it. The physicality has around the pitch is superb. And I love watching him play. Fingers crossed he can keep this going because he's a top player.
Yeah, he's 30. It's kind of the peak of his career, hopefully now, and he can maintain that as a front row for the next couple of years. I did want to ask you about Will Addison as well, because there's a lot of calls to put him in the team. Alan Quinlan was on with us.
I don't know why though, Ger. Somebody who's played so little rugby over the last couple of months to be thrown into an international jersey, like it doesn't add up. I am a huge fan of Will Addison. I think he's got all the attributes. I think he's got all the skills. Every time he touches the ball, he seems to have, time and space. But he's never fit. How can you play somebody that's never fit?
Maybe it's this archetypal situation in Irish sport where in your absence, we talk about you and talk about you and your reputation becomes a world beater.
Yep.
I think maybe they just also want to see what it would be like having somebody else who has his distribution skills in the back line.
Yeah, of course. I would love to see that. I would love to see a fully fit Will Addison been able to do that. But like I was chatting to Mark Cueto a couple of years from Seal Sharks. He's been heavily involved with the Irish Legends versus English Legends game over the last number of years, raising a lot of money for charity. And he was saying to me, he says, Will Addison, he says, Stevie, what an exceptional player. He says, absolutely fantastic. You guys have got a real gem coming over to Ireland. However, when he's fit, but he's never, ever fit. And I went, all right, okay. And this was a couple of years ago before he'd signed for Ulster. And now we're seeing the same thing. I'm not one to preach about injuries, guys. I had my fair share and, was on the sidelines for a hell of a lot of my career. But, I think he just needs a run of games. And, there's only so long you can kind of say that. He was patched up. I watched him against Bath in the European Cup. He was patched up for that game. I don't think he's finished a game in quite a long time. So, yeah, I'm not sure throwing him into an international setup against England or against France in the next few weeks is the right thing for him, to be honest.
All right, Stevie, we'll leave it there. Great stuff with you this morning. Thanks a million for joining us.
Thanks, lads.
Oh, it was great to have Stephen Ferris giving us his thoughts on the situation with regards to the Ireland rugby team at the minute. If you have any comments for us, you can use the hashtag OTBAM, or you can follow us at OffTheBallAM is the specific Twitter account for this show as well. Now, Tom Malone is here with us to talk to us about what's going on in the world of sport. But we got to start with Tiger Roll.
Yeah, sure, we'll start with Tiger
Roll. The noises coming out of the O'Learys is loud and deep and guttural and unhappy.
Yeah, there was quite a, it was a really telling interview on Sky Sports Racing yesterday when Sean Boyce spoke to Eddie O'Leary in the immediate aftermath. I mean, you kind of need to parse away the stuff from the dinner yesterday, because the launch was yesterday and everyone turned up at about 11 o'clock and then the interviews were, you know, after lunch when everyone had been, you know, quieting down and hadn't really, you know, they'd been there about 4 or 5 hours at this stage. Whereas Eddie O'Leary was full of fight and talk on Sky Sports Racing yesterday. Very disappointed. Can't believe that the horse is rated the same rate as Delta Work, who's a dual grade one winner. There are some winners come out of this, by the way. We're putting up an article on offtheball.com about who potentially has come out on the right side of these handicap compressions. To a point, Tiger Roll has, but I would definitely argue that his rating was too high in the first place.
So he's rated at 170.
His official rating is 171. He's been brought down to 170 for the purpose of this race, as has Delta Work.
You were speculating yesterday that 167 would have been fair.
Yeah, 167, 168 would be fair, but 170 is actually not unfair. But when you consider horses like Bristol Demai have been dropped to Native River, who won last time out, has placed in two Gold Cups, has won a Gold Cup, has been placed, has won a Hennessy, like, it's just never been out of the top four when he's raced at Cheltenham in a festival, got dropped 2 pounds, even though he won last time out in a Grade 2 chase. He got dropped 2 pounds. You know, that
doesn't
stack up.
What's Native River off now?
He's off one, so he'll be getting 2 pounds from Tiger Roll.
Right.
Even though he's a previous Gold Cup winner. When you compare that to Annabelle Fly, who's been bang out of form, has been, you know, he's been running behind Delta Work, but with no spark of life whatsoever. He was raised 4 pounds. Then Aso, a horse of Venetia Williams, who'd have arguably a similar kind of level of form or performance, he was dropped 4 pounds. So, and then you're someone like Jet, who trained by Jessica Harrington, also trained in Ireland, similar level of form, pootling around the back of Grade Ones, he was raised 4 pounds. So there's British horses getting dropped in the compression and Irish horses just getting raised. Like, obviously the top two are catching headlines. Yeah.
Is there like
is there
a Brexit element to this?
If you look at the top 50 horses in the race, of the Irish trained horses, 3 of them have been dropped. There's Tiger Roll and Delta Work, both dropped 1 pound. And then if you go the whole way down to Chef Des Oboe, who's number 49 on the list, he got dropped 1 pound.
Right.
And pretty much anything else is either a raising or just level. Whereas you look in the top 10, English-trained horses, and quite a few of them have been dropped for recent performances.
Okay.
So there is a Brexit element. Now, look, it's a British race run, a British... So, like, obviously they should stick with their handicap ratings more, but more British horses have been dropped than Irish horses on their previous runs.
Right. You'd almost say it was a coincidence.
So, you know... When things settle down a little bit, for all the, oh no, we're happy with a lovely racing weight, when you just pour through them a little bit, I think more connections would be a little bit more angry when the wine from yesterday's dinner wears off a little, yeah.
Tom's piece coming up on offtheball.com in a couple of minutes' time. So what else have you got for us?
I was sorry, the championship last night, the crazy, crazy championship. Leeds United remain in the automatic promotion positions after last night's 1-1 draw with Brentford. Liam Cooper's goal earned a point for Leeds, but they've taken just 10 points from a possible last 33. While fellow promotion hopefuls Nottingham Forest missed out on a chance to go into the top two as well. They lost to Charlton 1-0. Republic of Ireland striker Scott Hogan scored his third in as many games for Birmingham, who are 1-0 winners away to Barnsley, while Darragh Lenihan opened the scoring for Blackburn in their 3-0 win at home to Hull. Wigan and Middlesbrough drew 2-2, while Swansea and QPR played out a goalless draw. Tonight, West Bromwich Albion can go further clear at the top of the championship if they can get the better of Reading, who currently sit 16th. Elsewhere, Fulham will go second with a win at 11th place Millwall. Bristol City take on Derby. Cardiff go to Huddersfield. Luton play Sheffield Wednesday and Stoke entertain Preston. Leeds, of course, currently on 56 points. Just 6 points separate them and Bristol City, who lie outside the playoff places. Damien Delaney was on the show last night, obviously played plenty of football in the championship, and he says it's a really tough league to get out of.
What about 46 league games versus 38 league games? Would your body know the difference?
Oh, did listen, unbelievable. I mean, for me getting out of the championship at the time I did couldn't have come at a more kind of precious time, because I think I was 30, 31, and I had 10 years of that championship. Now, that is physically and mentally the most demanding league you could ever wish to play in. Anyone that's had 4 or 5 seasons in that knows, you know, if you're averaging 50 games a season between cup competitions and stuff like that, it's a slog, it's difficult, and these players are getting to that stage now that I think the championship becomes survival of the fittest. You know, all tight, all passing and, you know, shape and niceties. It's just about getting it over the line right now. And I think that's something possibly where Leeds are falling down right now. You know, you just have to just show character, grit, determination, and just get results over the line and get to where you need to go to. It's difficult, very, 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 very difficult.
Yeah, they probably, their goal scoring has been terrible as well, in fairness to Leeds. And let's move on to the GAA. The announced record revenues yesterday in the annual report of €73.4 million. Attendances and gate receipts both up. The redevelopment of Porky Cueve left the executive in Cork, meanwhile, with a €20 million debt. It's been revealed. Director Tom Ryan's, I heard earlier, doesn't think that redevelopment stadium on Leaside is a white elephant, but he also spoke to OTB about plans for the GAA's Clonliffe Road site.
Always, always secondary of anything that we do in this place. But it's an unfortunate consequence of the world that we live in, that we need to generate funds in order to further all the stuff that we're more interested in. You heard this morning, Jeremy Ryan talking about the scale of some of the projects that are ahead of us in terms of county grounds and so on. And there's been a real change in the last 10 years, 5 years. The cost of doing these things is almost beyond the reach of what we can generate from our just day-to-day taking people through the turnstile. So you need to think a little bit differently about how you can safeguard the association for the future in terms of capital projects. The Clonliffe project is one such way of doing that. In broad terms, what we've done is we've acquired the grounds of Clonliffe College. We're in the throes of disposing of portions of that for development. We'll retain, and the disposals will, by and large, will fund the acquisition costs. We'll retain some assets, we'll retain some pitches, we'll retain some pieces of land. We plan to build a hotel on one such site, and that will generate an income for the association for the foreseeable future. If you think about it, the hotel that we have at the moment across Jones's Road, you know, that contributes a seven-figure rent into the association every year. You'll have seen that in the distribution from the stadium back into the GAA, and that then is distributed on the same basis as all the other funds that we receive throughout the year, John.
Yeah, so the just more, I guess, more in that funding, isn't it? But
yeah, that full interview available on our social channels. Good in-depth stuff with John Dogan yesterday. So look, Tom Ryan praised for the tone and tenor and ambition of his report. A little bit earlier on with Paul Rice in the studio. If you missed that, it's definitely worth listening back to.
Yeah, it's a fascinating insight, and he's very giving in it as well, in fairness to him. Finally, we'll finish with On the Pitch in the GAA tonight. DJ Carey is hoping to lead IT Carlow to a first ever Fitzgibbon Cup win this evening. They face holders UCC at the DCU Sports Ground, throwing in at 7:30.
We shouldn't gloss over that. That would be an absolutely seismic achievement.
Incredible.
If DJ Carey wins for IT Carlow, Fitzgibbon Cup, that is an unbelievable achievement. That's like, give me your best March Madness Hoosiers story and I give you DJ Carey and his own personal story over the last decade for Carlow IT. Like,
yeah, and because I know as well, he coaches some like junior clubs down in Kilkenny as well, down, I think it's Paulstown or Thomastown around there, like, and he's had brilliant success with them, and they are an absolute like junior club as well, and he's done brilliantly with them too.
Like, so they do have a quality team. Like, that's obviously how they've got here this far. Like, it's not like,
but they didn't get the quality team overnight.
No,
right? They had to build this up over a period of time.
Obviously not. It's going to be a massive achievement if they manage to do this weekend. But like, it's like with some of the players that they have, you would expect them to cause a scalp or two. Going out and winning the entire thing, you would have expected it would be a step too far. And certainly not something many people would have predicted at the start. But like, just looking, like, I know the fact that they managed to to beat Mary Eye was a huge thing for
them. They hammered Mary Eye, didn't they?
Yeah. Like you look at Richie Lahey in there, Liam Blanchfield play that night. Like Shane Reck is in that team. Like there are strong players across the side, but then like it was 5-14 to 15 points. So and given the players that Mary Eye have, that's not something you would have expected at all. This is like the successor to Brian Cody is up there as one of the more fascinating.
It's funny because he's anointed them. He's created them as well. He's created these successors, like, and whether it's, you know, a Shefflin or a Kerry or.
It's almost as if like Eddie Brennan now needs to go out and win an All Ireland at least to be kind of back in the contention
with the conversation.
Shefflin and DJ, because they seem to be doing their own thing.
Like he could partner up with one of them. You could have a dream ticket of DJ and Eddie Brennan, the greatest inside forward line, like potentially an inside forward line team of the millennium, and Shefflin's out looking, we'll stick you at half forward. Stick you left half forward. Like, that's where you did a lot of your good damage when, you know, you needed to rescue games. You'd go out there, win a few balls, gee the crowd up.
Could they become like the three apostles to take Kilkenny back to?
Wow. What an idea. Who's big dog eats first, though? Who's big dog?
Henry.
Just because he's got the moral Islands.
Yeah, and he's also
so the biggest. And he is actually the biggest.
The medals stretch across my arm here. I'm getting way down. What's that? It's my medals.
The three of them, like a slow motion Reservoir Dogs style video of them walking into Nolan Park is how their era should start.
Mr. Brown. Who's Mr. Brown?
That would be Eddie.
No one's Mr. Brown. It doesn't exist. Mr. Shit. That was the...
Yeah.
Right, 9:27 this morning. We mentioned this earlier on this morning. Here's our update on the most recent developments in the George Gibney story. The former Irish swimming coach has been accused of 27 counts of indecent assault and unlawful carnal knowledge before he escaped conviction in Ireland in the 1990s. He's currently believed to be residing in Florida. There's been some new developments. Irvin Muchnick is an investigative journalist. He's been working on this story for the best part of two decades at this point. He's someone we've spoken to on the show a number of times. He joined Owen yesterday to bring us the very latest on George Gibney. Have a look.
We are turning our attention back to the George Gibney story. George Gibney, of course, the former Irish swimming coach who was accused of 27 counts of indecent assault and unlawful carnal knowledge before escaping conviction in the 90s following a Supreme Court ruling in 1993. He is currently believed to be living in Florida, and there has been a new development in this situation. Investigative journalist Irvin Muchnick has been digging into this case in great detail over the past few years, and delighted to welcome back Irvin to the show. Irvin, you're very welcome.
Yes, thanks for having me again. Good to be here.
So basically, if you want to read any of Irvin's work, by the way, you can go on to concussioninc.net. And your latest piece there, Irvin, talks about the fact that the Department of Justice in the United States are now on this case.
Yes, I mean, we kind of have it surrounded now. We have everything except the shoe dropping. We know that there's a federal grand jury in New York, and in the American justice system, grand juries work with prosecutors to figure out whether persons and entities should be indicted for crimes. It's a kind of preliminary phase of a case. But the fact that there's a grand jury investigating USA Swimming for financial impropriety and insurance fraud and cover-ups of sexual abuse cases in the United States is related to the Gibney matter. And the Gibney matter, as I've been saying for years, is a global issue, not just the story of individual coaches in Ireland who needed to be thrown under the bus and in some cases thrown into prison. Mm. So this grand jury has been operating through all of 2019. It's been reported by the Wall Street Journal and other prominent American newspapers. But what hasn't been reported is the related George Gibney aspect of the investigation, which I know has been happening for at least the last year. And I've now confirmed the office at the Department of Justice headquarters in Washington, D.C. that is working on the Gibney matter. It's called MLARS, which stands for Money Laundering and Asset Recovery Section. The person working on it, who I know you don't want me to name, is a longtime corruption prosecutor who joined the federal government in December of 2018. And her title is Human Trafficking Finance Specialist. So it's possible that this George Gibney investigation is related to USA Swimming financial improprieties that are also being probed by the federal government. It's possible that it's just an add-on to the federal grand jury investigation, but I can say with certainty that it's happening. Now, what hasn't happened is an indictment of George Gibney or an extradition order. These things have been happening with other foreign national Olympic coaches who've been living in the United States. A Mexican gymnastics coach in the Chicago area is now in the process of being deported. But it has a wrinkle with George Gibney because he didn't become a citizen. He was denied citizenship in 2010. The reason apparently being, from the records that I've been able to acquire under a Freedom of Information Act settlement with the Department of Homeland Security, the reason apparently being that Gibney lied on his citizenship application about whether he had ever been charged with a crime. And that disqualified him from getting a successful citizenship application. But in a bureaucratic odd situation or wrinkle, the ICE office in the United States, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ruled that he could not be removed from the country because he had not been convicted of a crime.
Okay. Right, okay.
So there's a whole bunch of things we can discuss surrounding all that.
So the Mexican gymnastics coach that is being investigated, or that those proceedings are currently underway in the United States at the moment, the difference there between him and George Gibney is that he was an actual citizen of the United States. He was successful in his application, whereas it's just a little bit more tricky for them to try and track down George Gibney or to press charges on George Gibney because he's not a United States citizen. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, well, tracking him down is not an issue. I think we all know where he is, in Altamont Springs, Florida, near Orlando. There's this perverse ruling by ICE that it would have been better if George Gibney had gotten citizenship and then we had found that he was lying than the fact that U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services caught the fact that he was lying when he applied and said he couldn't become a citizen. Now, a very distinguished federal judge in 2016, Charles Breyer, said this completely baffled him because he knew of cases where American citizens had their passports taken away when they made false representations to the government. So he doesn't quite get it. But nonetheless, that's where we are. And of course, as I was reporting last year, the federal agents who have been investigating Gibney sort of decided last year, rather than try to untangle all the bureaucratic verbal gymnastics around lying on a citizenship application and failing, as opposed to lying on a citizenship application and succeeding, they decided to focus on actual nefarious activities that Gibney might have been involved in since he's become a resident alien in the mid-1990s. And that was his work in Peru with a children's medical mission sponsored by a Denver, Colorado area Catholic parish.
You might just explain once again that link with Peru there for anybody who missed your, I think it was in your ebook last year, if anybody wanted to check that out.
Right. So an employer in Wheat Ridge, Colorado, a suburb of Denver, busted Gibney the day after she hired him in 2000. His resume bragged about a bunch of things that he did, his work with at-risk kids in a college program and other things. But one line item said that he was chairman of the International Peru Eye Clinic Foundation through his Catholic Church in the Denver area. And she found out about his Irish past and informed on him to the local police, and they investigated. And as we've seen repeatedly through the George Gibney story, they didn't find a crime that they could hang on him. But there is a pretty thorough report by the police about everything they looked into, thorough that is, except for one aspect. They didn't track down the church that he was affiliated with, and all the details on this Peruvian children's medical mission. Mm. Now, what my ebook found was that during the same period, a sect in the Peruvian Catholic Church called Sodalicium Christianae Vitae, which is very controversial and has recently acknowledged that its founder and other leaders engaged in sexual abuse, kidnapping, and other crimes. They were looking to export their assets out of Peru because of many lawsuits that were coming down the line. And they expanded their operations into the United States and other countries. And their foothold in the United States is the Archdiocese of Denver. Now, again, I haven't completely confirmed every detail of this, only that it's an odd connection that I understand federal agents have been exploring, and I don't know what the final upshot of that is. But that's the Peru connection.
Yeah, well, that is one of the possible things that federal employees could possibly be investigating at the moment, because when you mentioned at the start that the Department of Justice is perhaps linking George Gibney into a separate USA Swimming investigation, it's hard to actually pinpoint what the exact thing is that they might investigate. So what you have is a potential list of theories, I presume, Irvin. I don't assume you've got the information yet to the path that they will go down to try and investigate Gibney specifically.
Yes, don't have the specifics, but we have a little bit of an algorithm now,
sure,
knowing that the Washington, D.C. Justice Department office is being coordinated by a human trafficking finance specialist, and that the office involves money laundering and asset recovery. So possibly there is a nexus, as there is in the United States, between financial impropriety and sexual abuse. I know that the federal grand jury that's been reported by the major newspapers in the U.S. is looking into things like the offshore reinsurance operation of USA Swimming in the Caribbean island of Barbados. It's very okay. Technical, involved, money-changing stuff. I can't say with great confidence that that's exactly related to George Gibney, or if it's just a sort of add-on to what the grand jury is doing in New York. But we know that Washington and the Southern District of New York are talking to each other about these things, and that this seems to be the mechanism by which something would happen with George Gibney.
How quickly do we expect developments in this, Irvin? In the United States of America, do these sort of things take months, years, before we actually see what direction officials might be going down?
Yeah, well, as I was saying all of last year, and now I feel like I have the whole thing surrounded, it's kind of like predictions are not that valuable. How many days, how many weeks, how many months? And it's kind of a chicken and egg situation where we don't know how aggressively the Irish government is asking the United States to extradite Gibney. We don't know how eager the U.S. is to deport Gibney if they don't know that Ireland is actually going to take him and put him on trial for these allegations, old and new, against him. So I don't know what comes first, the chicken or the egg. I can only report what I know and keep reporting it, and hoping that that people, more formidable media players than myself in the United States and the Irish media and public, will continue to bring pressure to bear on governments both there and here to make this finally happen.
As a final point then, Irvin, you've already mentioned that we're fairly certain of where George Gibney is currently based. Is he just operating as a normal citizen? Does he have a job in this part of Orlando? And when was the last time, for example, he's been cited or a photograph or some sort of footage has been published in the media, for example?
Well, I've talked an email as recently as yesterday with Evan Daly, who's the Irish-American gentleman who really deserves all the credit for bringing, you know, Gibney to any level of consciousness in the United States. Because in 2010, he's the one who told the federal government about Gibney's past, and I think panicked Gibney into applying for citizenship. And the government was alert to the lies that he then told on his application. So Evan Daly has been a Gibney tracker for a number of years, and he tells me that Gibney is still in Central Florida. For all we know, he's hiding in plain sight. Mm-hmm. He's not involved in the swimming industry anymore and hasn't been for a number of years. But he's carrying on like your next door neighbor. And the last time there was like a big eruption of local awareness of Gibney was around 2010 when he left the house he previously had in Orlando and moved to Altamont Springs. And to the best of my knowledge, that's where things stand. So Gibney is there. He's a free man until he's not a free man. And he's unknown to the public in the United States until he's better known. Mm. And of course, I push that ball up the hill just about as much as I can.
Irvin, thanks a million for taking the call. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Owen.
OTB
AM. Brought to you by Pandora. Find the perfect gift this Valentine's Day.
OTB
AM. Brought to you by Pandora. Celebrate love with a special gift.
That was an Off the Ball Podcast Network presentation.